Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
I'd be interested to know how you are defining the words race and racism.
Say that, how do we, what?
How you are defining the words race and racism. Like, what is your definition?
That's interesting. Our definition of racism is the cultural experience of that black people, well, I'll talk for myself, the cultural experience that black people have suffered from in this country, being victimized because they were black by the dominant power structure in this country.
If you mean genetically, one could make a case that there are no real races, and we all go back to the original, have an original genetic pool in Africa. I think we are trying to more or less accept the way people are viewed in this country, not agree with it, but in that sense see race as that group of people. If you talk about black people as the African American race, it's the way people are viewed in the way that we use it in the book. Einstein at one point talked about the Jewish race when he was being discriminated against in Germany. He didn't use it in later years, but he did in his earlier years. I think he maybe saw it as that group of people who were under the thumb. You know, I don't know. Did you have something else in mind?
I've heard 100 definitions of racism and race, and I don't think that. I don't think I've heard one that really people are able to agree upon. I think that's probably the problem. I think that goes straight to. I'm sorry. Fred asked me what I had in mind when I asked the question, and I said that I have heard at least 100 different definitions of racism. And I think that that goes straight to the heart of the problem, that we have not hit upon and agreed upon definition. And so maybe that's why we are still left with this problem after so many hundreds of years.
I guess as a follow-up question to that, do you think that Einstein saw race as a social construct, or do you think he saw it as something that was genetic, which is, I think, a really interesting question, because I'm asking it for one, but also because I think that we've moved into a space where we talk about race very differently than it possibly was talked about then. And so I'd like to hear your perspectives on it, considering you all did so much research. So does Einstein, do you think that, what's your perspective on Einstein's take on race? Did he see it as a genetic situation, or did he see it as a social construct?
Go ahead. I'll say it. Oh, I guess my thought is he saw it as my guess is that he saw it as a social construct. I think he endeavored to treat people. He was a person who lived in a certain era. So he was certainly shaped by the by the society that he lived in, even though, as Fred said, part of his personality was to be independent and to be an independent thinker. So I think he made a great effort to treat people, to ignore race in terms of personal interactions, or to treat people the same. That's my take.
I think he viewed it, he was concerned with it as a social construct. His theories as to why, how races developed were fairly primitive. I don't think he was into genetics, into the science of genetics terribly much. I think he was mainly concerned with the way people were treated. And if you talk to the people in Princeton and you listen and you look in their eyes as they remember walking with Einstein, holding his hand, and having this feeling over and over again, you came up that he didn't have a racist bone in his body, they felt it. They felt something. This is in a town in which all white people seem to have nothing but racist bones in their body. You know, maybe I'm exaggerating slightly, but not too much. That he had something in it, in his eyes, in his feeling, in the way he reacted to people. And I think add to that the fact that he believed in doing something about it. I always have the sense that if Einstein were, you know, alive today, that he'd be leading the protest march against the killing of Diallo or one of the other victims of police brutality. And that would certainly get attention. I mean, if he did it. But I mean, that would be in keeping with his spirit, with his attitude. He wouldn't just sit on the sidelines and issue a pontification, you know, that, oh, it's too bad, it's a shame. And I think that's what we have to learn from him. We somehow have to take that with us, find a way to carry on that commitment.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, July 9th, 2020. So I have been told this is our final installment. Fred Jerome, Roger Taylor's Einstein on Race and Racism. We're picking up on Chapter 10 and going all the way to the conclusion. Not a very long book. Weren't going to be on it too long to begin with, so we'll finish up today. The audio segment that we started with, that was the authors, again, Roger Taylor, black male, and Fred Jerome, suspected white man, suspected racist. I think we had one of our listeners mentioned that portion of the interview some weeks back. In the exchange, where it was a black female audience member, asked them, what is your definition of racism? I and we, Cal's audience members, have heard that sort of response often from both white people and non-white people. Sometimes where they have written books, sometimes they'll be, you know, big university professors with, you know, all kinds of titles and degrees behind their name. And then you go, well, what's your definition of racism? That's a tough one. Didn't expect that one. Wow. Why don't we take your hand and begin with? Wait, I just wanted to, just came to come here and talk about my book, Race on Racism, Race and Racism. You think somebody would ask me a definition of racism? Let me see. Racism, what does that mean? Let me see if I... And they'll do the same thing. They will have written a whole book, footnotes, references, all that, on racism. And you say, well, what's your definition? And stumbling and fumbling. And I said, well, let me see. I'll see if I can concoct one. Like, what? Do what? Also, do not think it was lost on Gus T. We are in the midst of all this hoopla, protests, and snatching down statues, and cars running over protesters in the streets and everything. Hands up, don't shoot, right? In the midst of all that, this interview was from 2005. And he says, oh man, I think Einstein would have been right there protesting, right out there with Amadou Diallo. And what's the rest? Who is it? Eric Floyd, what's his name? Eric Garner, George Floyd. Yeah, he would have been right out there, whatever time period it is. Rodney King always got, generally, some black male that's been choked, anally raped, shot, suffocated. Always got some illustration of a black male who has been stomped out by race soldiers with a badge to reference. With that, we will get started. Final installment, Mel, spectacular effort. Woo! Einstein on Race and Racism, Context of White Supremacy, Audio Segment 1.
Chapter 10, Einstein and Robeson, 2. Einstein and Robeson met for a last time in October 1952, when Einstein again invited Robeson to his Princeton home. Their meeting went almost completely unreported. Even J. Edgar Hoover didn't know about it, as Einstein had sent the invitation to Robeson through a mutual friend, assuming, correctly, that the FBI was intercepting mail and phone calls. It was the height of the Red Scare. Fear of a foreign, evil empire was the rationale for the Red Scare, but to be successful, every witch hunt needs local witches, and Robeson was one of the highest on Hoover's witch list. Defiantly leftist, Robeson continued both to assail racial injustice in America and express friendship for the Soviet Union. In September 1949, a mob attacked his picnic concert at Peekskill, New York, stoning and beating picnickers, both black and white, screaming for Robeson's blood as state police watched and in some cases joined the mob's attack. The attack was not a massacre, only because thousands of labor union members and World War II veterans who had volunteered to defend the picnic formed a human wall around the grounds. The self-defense group had no weapons other than an occasional baseball bat for the game they hoped to hold after the concert. While the Peekskill attack has been reported, it is less well known that, under cover of the screaming mob, an attempt was made to assassinate Robeson. The self-defense group also sent scouts out into the surrounding woods before the concert began. At one point, they flushed up two local patriots who had made a little nest for themselves up there overlooking the valley, and they had high-powered rifles with telescopic sights. In other words, they wanted to kill Paul. The first two snipers were chased off, but to protect against others, an interracial group of tall, broad-shouldered veterans volunteered to stand behind Robeson as he sang, with full knowledge that they were providing a barrier of human flesh between him and possible snipers. Cars throughout Westchester County displayed bumper stickers declaring, "Wake up, America," Peekskill did, and "Communism is treason. Behind communism stands the Jew." Earlier that year, Einstein had written that America was half-fascistic. After Peekskill, the U.S. State Department, probably on orders from Hoover, canceled Robeson's passport, blocking him from accepting concert invitations from around the world. In just a few blacklisted years, he was barred from almost every concert hall in the country. Even black churches received threatening phone calls when they invited Robeson, and some canceled his performances in fear they would lose their insurance. Robeson's annual income plummeted from $100,000 to $6,000. Despite or because of that atmosphere, Einstein invited Robeson to visit him again. The two men spent the entire afternoon together, probably close to 6 hours. The conversation continued until it started to get dark outside, according to Lloyd Brown, Robeson's close friend and colleague, who accompanied him to Einstein's house. When they arrived, Helen Dukas ushered them upstairs to Einstein's working room that had been renovated so that half of its back wall was a huge picture window overlooking a garden. Einstein was reclining on a sofa with a fly swatter in his hand. Brown reported, "And when we walked in, he waved the fly swatter and said, 'This is my war.'" One of Brown's stories about that session, quoted often, is worth repeating here. At one point, when Robeson left the room, Brown, nervously trying to make conversation, said, "Dr. Einstein, it is an honor to be in the presence of a great man." Einstein frowned, clearly annoyed, and replied, "But you came in with a great man." Understanding what happened at that meeting between Einstein and Robeson is key to appreciating the bond between the two men. Brown's account gives us some idea of the content of their discussion. They talked about everything from music, Einstein regretfully said he was no longer able to play the violin, to why Einstein had recently declined an invitation to become president of Israel. Einstein said he had been opposed to the Jewish state since the beginning. He had been in favor of a binational state. He said, "When you have a state, then you get an army," and he was sorry the binational state didn't happen. He said he had written about this, and it was in his book of essays, Out of My Later Years. In response to Einstein's questions, Robeson reported on his efforts to resist McCarthyism at home, as well as the intensifying freedom struggle in South Africa. Einstein said he thought the South Africans should use Gandhi's tactics of passive resistance, and 8 years before the student sit-ins launched the civil rights movement, Einstein argued that black Americans, too, should adopt nonviolence as their strategy. Fascinating as the conversation must have been, some meetings mean more than their agendas, and this was one of them. The only two public accounts of that session, a column by Robeson in the Harlem-based newspaper Freedom, and Brown's interview on Gil Noble's television program Like It Is, emphasized the importance to Robeson of Einstein's support at a time when the singer was under the sharpest political attack. Quote, "Dr. Einstein expressed warm sympathy for my fight for the right to travel," unquote, Robeson reported in his column 2 weeks after their meeting. In Brown's words, Einstein's invitation was a definite act of solidarity, especially coming after Peekskill. But something else, at least equally important, may have occurred that October afternoon in Princeton. If Einstein had simply wanted to make a showing of solidarity, as the host, especially given his poor health, he could have ended the meeting gracefully after an hour. That he didn't do so is a clue to how much the session with Robeson meant to him. At the Institute for Advanced Study, the great scientist's 30-year search for a unified field theory, linking the forces of gravity and electromagnetism to one underlying force, continued, so far without the positive results he hoped for. But he was used to pitting his stubborn curiosity against the unknown. It was the state of the world, not the universe, that aggravated Einstein. As the planet's richest, most powerful country, sweat-drenched in Red Scare hysteria, rushed to build bigger, better, and deadlier bombs, Einstein's politics became increasingly anti. From the house on Mercer Street, his interviews and articles warned of potential catastrophe and even annihilation. August of 1952 found Einstein in a serious state of gloom, deepening for nearly 3 years, over the political situation in America and the parallels he saw to Germany just a few decades earlier. "You are very right in assuming that I am badly in need of encouragement," he wrote in November 1950 to a friend in Indiana. "Our nation has gone mad. America's obsession with anti-communism and the rising tide of political fear reminds me of the events in Germany." 2 months later, he wrote, "The dear Americans have vigorously assumed the Germans' place. The German calamity of years ago repeats itself. People acquiesce and align themselves with the forces of evil, and one stands by, powerless." And in another letter to friends in Europe, "I hardly ever felt as alienated from people as right now. The worst is that nowhere is there anything with which one can identify. Everywhere brutality and lies." And again, on January 31st, 1951, "Honest people constitute a hopeless minority." One significant event on May 8th, 1951, must have deepened his depression. Willie McGee was electrocuted by the state of Mississippi. As we have seen, McGee had been on death row for nearly 6 years while the worldwide campaign to save him had won reversal of 2 convictions and several stays of execution. The following month, Einstein wrote, "Those who propagandize against the alleged external enemy have won the support of the masses." By the start of 1952, he seemed to have almost lost hope. Saddest of all is the disappointment one feels over the conduct of mankind in general. And in September, just a few weeks before Robeson's visit, he wrote to a friend in Italy about his sense of loneliness and isolation. It is a safe bet that Einstein's support meant a great deal to the besieged Robeson. But the afternoon they spent together in October 1952 may have meant even more to Einstein. Did Einstein confide his sense of hopelessness to Robeson? He probably didn't need to. Dr. Einstein asked me about my life today as an artist, Robeson wrote in his account of their conversation. We can imagine Einstein's eyes widen as Robeson described his most recent concert. 5 months earlier, after the government had barred him from going to Canada, where he had been invited by that country's mine workers' union, he sang at the Peace Arch spanning the border between Washington State and British Columbia, Canada. Some 40,000 union members turned out on the Canadian side and cheered as Robeson, standing on the U.S. side, sang into a microphone that sent his magnificent voice and his defiance across the barred border. We don't know what spurred Einstein's return from despair in 1953, but Robeson's visit might well have helped. 6 hours discussing strategies for social change with the colleague Einstein admired, receiving reports about struggles around the world, and hearing the great artist, activist, and friend describe the response to each new vindictive government attack, more protest rallies, concerts, and organizing, could not have hurt Einstein's morale. In any case, there is no doubt that by the beginning of 1953, he no longer felt powerless. In January, he spoke out against the death sentence for the Rosenbergs, and a few months later, publicly challenged Senator McCarthy, calling on witnesses to refuse to cooperate with congressional investigators, even if it meant going to jail. His challenge to the inquisitors, Einstein's words, made the front page of the New York Times twice in 6 months. On June 12th, reporting on his letter to Brooklyn schoolteacher William Frauenglaus, the Times headline read, "Refuse to testify, Einstein advises intellectuals called in by Congress." Since the Times was a media agenda setter, then and now, Einstein's defiance became national and international news. Senator McCarthy, predictably, called him an enemy of America. But Einstein's friend, Eric Koehler, observed that after Einstein's decision to stir the conscience of the public, he underwent a dramatic mood change. "I have never seen him so cheerful and sure of his cause." Einstein and Robeson had their differences, to be sure, including significantly their estimates of the Soviet Union. Robeson loyally supported Moscow, while Einstein felt the Stalin regime had become an anti-Semitic dictatorship. But both clearly believed that what they shared was more important. And as one uncovers more about their friendship, it is surprising to learn how much they had in common. These two giants, who belonged to the world but also to Witherspoon Street, were not only friends but shared a passionate belief in the brotherhood and sisterhood of human beings, in music as a great international unifier, and in the right and responsibility of all of us to resist fascists and lynchers everywhere. They both believed also that it is possible to have a more equitable society than one where private profit is God. But, perhaps most important, and it may well be they came to understand this during that afternoon they spent together in 1952, they shared the belief that when it comes to social justice, you don't have to win, but you do have to keep struggling. It was a sentiment Einstein expressed a year before he died when he said, "The struggle for human rights is an eternal struggle in which a final victory can never be won. But to tire in that struggle would mean the ruin of society." It was also a commitment Robeson immortalized when, singing at a mass rally for the anti-fascist forces in Spain, he changed the line from Old Man River from, "I'm tired of living but scared of dying," to, "I must keep fighting until I'm dying." Chapter 11. My Friend, Dr. Einstein. 2 days after Einstein's death on April 18, 1955, a headline in the Daily Princetonian declared, "Neighboring kids unfold legend about their friend, Mr. Einstein." Einstein's long and friendly relationship with the children of Princeton was the subject of this piece, from a young girl who claimed to give him gumdrops for help with her arithmetic, to three boys who in the summer would meet Dr. Einstein for water gun battles and bring an extra water gun for him. However, one special child, an African-American child, was described as the doctor's most constant friend. In 1955, he was 11 years old. His name was Harry Morton, and as readers were told, he was from Battle Road. I'd be doing homework, and he'd, Einstein, come by every day, around 4, all alone, with his dachshund just shuffling along with his feet dragging, looking down at the ground. So I would run out and meet him, and we walked and talked and traded jokes. I hardly ever understood them. They were all about arithmetic and things, but I laughed anyway. Harry would often visit the scientist at home, the Princetonian report continued. Einstein showed him his chemistry equipment in the cellar and let him stay until supper while he worked at his desk. He always wrote for about 10 minutes with funny numbers, then he got up and walked around the desk twice. Once in a while, he got real mad. According to Evelyn Turner, a neighborhood friend who looked after Harry Morton, Harry lived with us for about 4 years when he was in the second, third, fourth, and possibly fifth grades. While he didn't talk with me directly about Einstein, I remember Harry talking with the other boys about how he had met him. I remember that Harry was a very bright boy, very talkative, very inquisitive, and he had no fear of strangers. He would visit his mother at the Ada Lutz home on weekends and go to their church on Sunday mornings, too. Every Sunday night, his mother would drop him off at our house. She thought it was better for Harry to be raised in a place where there were other children his own age. Harry Morton passed away in 1992. Joy Morton, his wife, had these recollections. To Harry, Einstein was just a man that he knew. My husband never played this up. My daughter asked me how her father and Einstein got to be friends. Harry's mother worked as a domestic for Dr. Frank Adelot, who was then head of the Institute for Advanced Study. Their house sat on the property of the Institute, 88 Battle Road. You used to be able to come down Battle Road and drive on to the Institute. Einstein used to go by the house every day, well, every few days, and he and Harry would go for walks. As I've told my daughter, knowing your father, he would be right there when Einstein walked his dog. This was almost every day for 3 or 4 years. Later, when the Mortons moved to Clay Street, Einstein still came by. I think Harry was 11 when Einstein died. Harry told me he used to walk with Einstein. I could not imagine it. Him walking with Albert Einstein. And he's telling me they were very good friends. I was like, yeah, all right. It was not registering with me. It wasn't until his mother verified what he was saying that it became real to me. His mother worked for Ada Lutz. They stayed in the same house when the next family, the Lilienthals, moved in. Not only did Harry have a brilliant vocabulary, but from a young age he had that way of being able to talk to anybody and had a deep understanding of things way beyond his years. Harry would talk about some racist things in Princeton. Jackson Street was the dividing line. It later became Paul Robeson Place. That's where the black community started. From there on down to Woodbridge Avenue, that's where 90% of the black people lived. Blacks didn't do a whole lot of venturing out. We're talking about a lot of brilliant people who didn't even try to go to Princeton University. There was an invisible line that they didn't cross. They wanted Harry to apply to Princeton, but he didn't want to. Harry would go over to Einstein's house sometimes. He would try to get answers from him for his homework, but Einstein couldn't get Harry's homework. He would go down in Einstein's basement to see the chemistry equipment. Harry accepted him as a really nice old man. Alice Satterfield commented, "You didn't have to be a scientist to be invited into Einstein's house. He was just very down to earth. Too bad they made that absent-minded image of him." Part 2. Documents. Chapter 1. Einstein's Statements on Race and Racism. Einstein's anti-racist statements and articles are brought together here for the first time. Some have never been published before, others rarely. Document A. To American Negroes, The Crisis, February 1932. With letters from and an editor's note by W.E.B. Du Bois, October 14, 1931. Mr. Albert Einstein, Habelenstrasse, 5, Berlin, West 30, Germany. Sir, I am taking the liberty of sending you herewith some copies of The Crisis magazine. The Crisis is published by American Negroes and in defense of the citizenship rights of million peoples descended from the former slaves of this country. We have just reached our 21st birthday. I am writing to ask if, in the midst of your busy life, you could find time to write us a word about the evil of race prejudice in the world. A short statement from you of 500 to 1,000 words on this subject would help us greatly in our continuing fight for freedom. With regard to myself, you will find something about me in Who's Who in America. I was formerly a student of Wagner and Schmoller in the University of Berlin. I should greatly appreciate word from you. Very sincerely yours, W.E.B. Du Bois. Einstein replied on October 29, 1931. Mr. W. E. Burghardt Du Bois, Editor, The Crisis, 69 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York. My dear sir, please find enclosed a short contribution for your newspaper. Because of my excessive workload, I could not send a longer explanation. With distinguished respect, Albert Einstein. Two American Negroes, a note from the editor, Dr. Du Bois. The author, Albert Einstein, is a Jew of German nationality. He was born in Württemberg in 1879 and educated in Switzerland. He has been professor of physics at Zurich and Prague and is at present director of the Kaiser Wilhelm Physical Institute at Berlin. He is a member of the Royal Prussian Academy of Science and of the British Royal Society. He received the Nobel Prize in 1921 and the Copley Medal in 1925. Einstein is a genius in higher physics and ranks with Copernicus, Newton, and Kepler. His famous theory of relativity, advanced first in 1905, is revolutionizing our explanation of physical phenomena and our conception of motion, time, and space. But Professor Einstein is not a mere mathematical mind. He is a living being, sympathetic with all human advance. He is a brilliant advocate of disarmament and world peace, and he hates race prejudice because, as a Jew, he knows what it is. At our request, he has sent this word to the Crisis with Ausgezeichnete Hochachtung, distinguished respect. It seems to be a universal fact that minorities, especially when their individuals are recognizable because of physical differences, are treated by majorities among whom they live as an inferior class. The tragic part of such a fate, however, lies not only in the automatically realized disadvantages suffered by these minorities in economic and social relations, but also in the fact that those who meet such treatment themselves, for the most part, acquiesce in the prejudiced estimate because of the suggestive influence of the majority and come to regard people like themselves as inferior. This second and more important aspect of the evil can be met through closer union and conscious educational enlightenment among the minority, and so emancipation of the soul of the minority can be attained. The determined effort of the American Negroes in this direction deserves every recognition and assistance. Albert Einstein. In response, Dr. Du Bois wrote again, November 12, 1931, Professor Albert Einstein, Berlin, West Germany, 30. My dear Professor Einstein, I am under deep obligations to you for the statement which you sent us. I know how busy you must be, and it is exceedingly kind for you to take time for writing this. I shall take the liberty of sending you a copy of my magazine each month. Very sincerely yours, W.E.B. Du Bois. Document B. Address at the inauguration of the Wall of Fame at the World's Fair in New York, 1940. It is a fine and high-minded idea, also, in the best sense, a proud one, to erect at the World's Fair a Wall of Fame to immigrants and Negroes of distinction. The significance of the gesture is this. It says, these two belong to us, and we are glad and grateful to acknowledge the debt that the community owes them. And, focusing on these particular contributors, Negroes and immigrants, shows that the community feels a special need to show regard and affection for those who are often regarded as stepchildren of the nation. For why else this combination? If then I am to speak on the occasion, it can only be to say something in behalf of these stepchildren. As for the immigrants, they are the only ones to whom it can be accounted a merit to be Americans, for they have had to take trouble for their citizenship, whereas it has cost the majority nothing at all to be born in the land of civic freedom. As for the Negroes, the country has still a heavy debt to discharge for all the troubles and disabilities it has laid on the Negro's shoulders, for all that his fellow citizens have done and to some extent are still doing for him. To the Negro and his wonderful songs and choirs, we are indebted for the finest contribution in the realm of art which America has so far given to the world. And this great gift we owe not to those whose names are engraved on this wall of fame, but to the children of the people, blossoming namelessly as the lilies of the field. In a way, the same is true of immigrants. They have contributed in their way to the flowering of the community, and their individual striving and suffering have remained unknown. One more thing I would say with regard to immigration generally, there exists on the subject a fatal miscomprehension. Unemployment is not decreasing by restricting immigration, for unemployment depends on faulty distribution of work among those capable of work. Immigration increases consumption as much as it does demand on labor. Immigration strengthens not only the internal economy of a sparsely populated country, but also its defensive power. The Wall of Fame arose out of a high-minded ideal. It is calculated to stimulate just and magnanimous thoughts and feelings. May it work to that effect. Document C. The Negro Question. Pageant. January 1946. I am writing as one who has lived among you in America only a little more than 10 years, and I am writing seriously and warningly. Many readers may ask, what right has he to speak out about things which concern us alone, and which no newcomer should touch? I do not think such a point is justified. One who has grown up in an environment takes much for granted. On the other hand, one who has come to this country as a mature person may have a keen eye for everything peculiar and characteristic. I believe he should speak out freely on what he sees and feels, for by doing so he may perhaps prove himself useful. What soon makes the new arrival devoted to this country is the democratic trait among the people. I am not thinking here so much of the democratic political constitution of this country, however highly it must be praised. I am thinking of the relationship between individual people and the attitude they maintain toward one another. In the United States, everyone feels assured of his worth as an individual. No one humbles himself before another person or class. Even the great difference in wealth, the superior power of a few, cannot undermine this healthy self-confidence and natural respect for the dignity of one's fellow man. There is, however, a somber point in the social outlook of Americans. Their sense of equality and human dignity is mainly limited to men of white skins. Even among these there are prejudices of which I, as a Jew, am clearly conscious, but they are not important in comparison with the attitude of the whites toward their fellow citizens of darker complexion, particularly towards Negroes. The more I feel an American, the more this situation pains me. I can escape the feeling of complicity in it only by speaking out. Many a sincere person will answer me, our attitude towards Negroes is the result of unfavorable experiences, which we have had by living side by side with Negroes in this country. They are not our equals in intelligence, sense of responsibility, reliability. I am firmly convinced that whoever believes this suffers from a fatal misconception. Your ancestors dragged these black people from their homes by force, and in the white man's quest for wealth and an easy life, they have been ruthlessly suppressed and exploited, degraded into slavery. The modern prejudice against Negroes is the result of the desire to maintain this unworthy condition. The ancient Greeks also had slaves. They were not Negroes, but white men who had been taken captive in war. There could be no talk of racial differences. And yet Aristotle, one of the great Greek philosophers, declared slaves inferior beings who were justly subdued and deprived of their liberty. It is clear that he was enmeshed in a traditional prejudice from which, despite his extraordinary intellect, he could not free himself. A large part of our attitude toward things is conditioned by opinions and emotions, which we unconsciously absorb as children from our environment. In other words, it is tradition, besides inherited aptitudes and qualities, which makes us what we are. We but rarely reflect how relatively small, compared with the powerful influence of tradition, is the influence of our conscious thought upon our conduct and convictions. It would be foolish to despise tradition, but with our growing self-consciousness and increasing intelligence, we must begin to control tradition and assume a critical attitude toward it. If human relations are ever to change for the better, we must try to recognize what in our accepted tradition is damaging to our fate and dignity and shape our lives accordingly. I believe that whoever tries to think things through honestly will soon recognize how unworthy and even fatal is the traditional bias against Negroes. What, however, can the man of goodwill do to combat this deeply rooted prejudice? He must have the courage to set an example by word and deed, and must watch lest his children become influenced by this racial bias. I do not believe there is a way in which this deeply entrenched evil can be quickly healed. But until this goal is reached, there is no greater satisfaction for a just and well-meaning person than the knowledge that he has devoted his best energies to the service of a good cause. Document D. Speech to Lincoln University Students and Faculty, May 3, 1946. The only possibility of preventing war is to prevent the possibility of war. International peace can be achieved only if every individual uses all of his power to exert pressure on the United States to see that it takes the leading part in world government. The United Nations has no power to prevent war, but it can try to avoid another war. The UN will be effective only if no one neglects his duty in his private environment. If he does neglect it, he is responsible for the death of our children in a future war. My trip to this institution was in behalf of a worthwhile cause. There is separation of colored people from white people in the United States. That separation is not a disease of colored people. It is a disease of white people. I do not intend to be quiet about it. The situation of mankind today is like that of a little child who has a sharp knife and plays with it. There is no effective defense against the atomic bomb. It can not only destroy a city, but it can destroy the very earth on which that city stood. Document E. Letter to President Harry S. Truman on Anti-Lynching Law, September 1946. September 1946. 2. The President of the United States, Honorable Harry S. Truman, the White House, Washington, D.C. May I wholeheartedly endorse the aims of this delegation in the conviction that the overwhelming majority of the American people is demanding that every citizen be guaranteed protection against acts of violence. To ensure such protection is one of the most urgent tasks for our generation. A way always exists to overcome legal obstacles whenever there is a determined will in the service of such a just cause. Yours respectfully, Albert Einstein. Document F. Message to the National Urban League Convention, September 16, 1946. Dr. Lester B. Granger, Executive Director, National Urban League, 1133 Broadway, New York City. My dear Dr. Granger, I greet your assembly in the conviction that it deals with one of the most important problems of this country. The contrast among groups is a constant threat which imperils minorities. This threat becomes more acute in times of economic stress and insecurity. However, the defeat of this threat is of importance not only for the minorities, but for the country as a whole. For an unleashed war of the groups against each other is the sure way to the loss of civil rights. Divide and rule has always been the maxim of tyrants and betrayers of the people. Pessimists have often claimed that mutual hostility among groups is unavoidable, because violence, distrust, and lust for power are indestructible and powerful characteristics of human nature that unceasingly influence the actions of men. No man of sound feeling and judgment is deluded by such an argument. Men are also greedy, yet we have achieved a state in which stealing is relatively rare. Every disease of society can be overcome if there is the firm will for a cure in the people. The worst disease under which the society of our nation suffers is, in my opinion, the treatment of the Negro. Everyone who is not used from childhood to this injustice suffers from the mere observation. Everyone who freshly learns of this state of affairs at a maturer age feels not only the injustice, but the scorn of the principles of the fathers who founded the United States that all men are created equal. He feels that this state of affairs is unsound in a country which, in many other things, is justly proud of a high degree of development. He cannot understand how men can feel superior to fellow men who differ in only one point from the rest. They descend from ancestors who, as a protection against the destructive action of the radiation of the tropical sun, gained more strongly pigmented skin than those whose ancestors lived in countries farther from the equator. One can hardly believe that a reasonable man can cling so tenaciously to such prejudice. And there is sure to come a time in which school children in their history lessons will laugh about the fact that something like this did once exist. Today, however, this prejudice is still alive and powerful. The fight against it is difficult, as is the fight on every issue in which the enemy has thoughtlessness and a fatal tradition on its side. What is to be done? There is a sound feeling of justice in the people. If we succeed in putting this feeling to the service of our cause, then the goal will be achieved. First, we must make every effort to ensure that the past injustice, violence, and economic discrimination will be made known to the people. The taboo, the let's not talk about it, must be broken. It must be pointed out time and again that the exclusion of a large part of the colored population from active civil rights by the common practices is a slap in the face of the Constitution of the nation. We must strive to ensure that minorities be protected against economic and political discrimination, as well as against attack by libelous writings and against the poisoning of youth in the schools. These endeavors are important, but not as important as the intellectual and moral enlightenment of the people. For example, it is clear that in the South, through economic pressure on the colored population, wages in general are kept down, and that thereby the majority of the people, white and black, suffers pauperization through reduced buying power. If the majority knew of the root of this evil, then the road to its cure would not be long. In our times, the consideration of the influence all things exert on world politics plays a special role. The fathers of our Constitution achieved a worldwide political effect by stating and realizing just principles that found enthusiastic agreement among good men everywhere. In our times, in which circumstances have placed great influence on international affairs into the hands of the United States, this nation could, for a second time, be the source of health and liberation, if we learn to base our influence not on battleships and atomic bombs, but on being a shining example in our internal affairs and on liberating creative ideas on social and world affairs. But without a just solution of the racial and more generally the minority problem, our example cannot be considered shining. One more remark. We have become accustomed to judge everything according to tangible and measurable viewpoints: food in calories, national and private income in dollars, ownership or non-ownership of a bathtub and of a water closet. In accordance with this attitude, I have spoken so far only of such tangible things as economic and political discrimination. These are really important. Yet, there are other things which are just as decisive for the happiness or unhappiness of the human being. A man may own everything that puts him on a high level according to a crudely materialistic point of view, and have a miserable existence. He may be persecuted by fear, hatred, or envy. He may be deaf to merry songs and blind to blooming life. It is similar for social groups, even for whole nations. There is a thing which one could call the moral climate of a society. In one society, there may be a preponderance of distrust, malice, and ruthless egotism. In another, the enjoyment of beauty and of blooming life, compassion for the suffering of one's fellow men and rejoicing in their happiness. This moral climate of the society to which we belong is of decisive influence on the value of life for each of us, and it cannot be understood through the tables of statistics, of economists, or in any scientific way. One thing is certain. No mechanism can give us a good moral climate as long as we have not freed ourselves from the prejudices to whose defeat you are devoting yourselves. Yours very sincerely, Albert Einstein. Document G, on Walter White, October 1947. Walter White, secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, was blonde, blue-eyed, and very fair-skinned, and might well have passed for white, but chose instead to organize and work for civil rights. In October 1947, his article, Why I Remain a Negro, appeared in the Saturday Review of Literature. Einstein sent the following letter to the editors, which was published on November 11, 1947. On reading the White article, one is struck with the deep meaning of the saying, "There is only one road to true human greatness, the road through suffering. If the suffering springs from the blindness and dullness of a tradition-bound society, it usually degrades the weak to a state of blind hate, but exalts the strong to a moral superiority and magnanimity, which would otherwise be almost beyond the reach of man." I believe that every sensitive reader will, as I did myself, put down Walter White's article with a feeling of true thankfulness. He has allowed us to accompany him on the painful road to human greatness by giving us a simple biographical story which is irresistible in its convincing power. Albert Einstein. Document H. Interview with the Cheney Record, October 1948. In October 1948, Einstein agreed to an interview with the Cheney Record, the student newspaper of Cheney State Teachers College, a black college in Pennsylvania, now Cheney University. Question: Do you feel that the scientists who gave us the atomic bomb should be held morally responsible for any destruction wrought by the bomb? Answer: No, it is true that advances in physics have made possible the application of scientific discoveries for technological and military purposes, which endangers great danger. The responsibility, however, lies with those who make use of these new discoveries rather than with those who contribute to the progress of science, with the politicians rather than the scientists. Question: Do you feel that race prejudice in the United States is merely a symptom of a worldwide conflict? Answer: Race prejudice has unfortunately become an American tradition which is uncritically handed down from one generation to the next. The only remedies are enlightenment and education. This is a slow and painstaking process in which all right-thinking people should take part. Question: Can mathematics be a tool for the solving of social problems as well as scientific considerations? Answer: Mathematics is a useful tool for social science. In the actual solution of social problems, however, goals and intentions are the dominant factors. Question: Do you feel that democracy can always solve the problems of society? Answer: Democracy, taken in its narrower, purely political sense, suffers from the fact that those in economic and political power possess the means for molding public opinion to serve their own class interests. The democratic form of government in itself does not automatically solve problems. It offers, however, a useful framework for their solution. Everything depends ultimately on the political and moral qualities of the citizenry. Question: Do you feel that a United States of Europe will solve the problem of war? Answer: Creation of a United States of Europe is an economic and political necessity. Whether it would contribute to a stabilization of international peace is hard to predict. I believe yes rather than no. Document I. Message to the Southwide Conference on Discrimination in Higher Education, sponsored by the Southern Conference Educational Fund, SCEF, Atlanta University, 1950. Established in New Orleans in 1946, SCEF's stated goal was to eradicate segregation in the South. Its membership and leadership included white and black Southerners. Aubrey Williams, former head of Roosevelt's National Youth Administration, was the first president of SCEF and remained so until the mid-1960s. Eleanor Roosevelt actively supported SCEF and helped buffer it against red-baiting attacks from racist senators like Bilbo of Mississippi and Talmadge of Georgia. After the Brown decision in 1954, SCEF worked closely with Martin Luther King Jr.'s Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. In the 1960s, under the leadership of Ann and Carl Braden, SCEF allied itself with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, SNCC. If an individual commits an injustice, he is harassed by his conscience. But nobody is apt to feel responsible for misdeeds of a community, in particular if they are supported by old traditions. Such is the case with discrimination. Every right-minded person will be grateful to you for having united to fight this evil that so grievously injures the dignity and the repute of our country. Only by spreading education among all of our people can we approach the ideals of democracy. Your fight is not easy, but in the end, you will succeed. Document J. Interview with Peter A. Buckey. Einstein. The longer I live in America, the more sad I feel about this situation. I have spoken with many people who have told me that they had bad feelings against Negroes because of unfavorable experiences that they had by living side by side with them. I've also been told that Negroes are not equal in intelligence or in their sense of reliability and that they are irresponsible. But I think that there is a certain amount of selfishness in this belief. By that I mean that American ancestors took these black people forcibly from their homes so that the white man could more easily acquire wealth. By suppressing and exploiting and degrading black people into slavery, the white man was able to have an easier life. I really think that it is as a result of a desire to maintain this condition that modern prejudices stem. Buckey, is there any relation between this anti-Negro sentiment and anti-Semitism? Einstein, only that it is part of the continuing story of man's inhumanity. Look, as far back as Greek times, people kept slaves. The only difference then was that the slaves were white people, and therefore could not be attacked due to racial differences. And yet, the Greek philosophers declared these slaves to be inferior. They, too, were deprived of their liberty. However, being a Jew myself, perhaps I can understand and empathize with how black people feel as victims of discrimination. Buckey, what do you think can be done in the long run to solve the problem? Einstein, well, there is no magic solution. I would only hope that where there is a will, there is a way. I think probably that Americans will have to realize how stupid this attitude is and how harmful it is, also to the standing of the United States. After all, every country is supposed to be looking up to this country, but I think that if individuals are really honest with themselves about this problem, they would undoubtedly recognize how wrong this bias really is. Document K. Letters from W.E.B. Du Bois, 1951. The renewed Einstein-Du Bois contact began early in 1951 when Einstein sent Du Bois a copy of his just-published book, Out of My Later Years. In April, Du Bois wrote back and included information about his federal indictment. April 20, 1951. Dr. Albert Einstein, 112 Mercer Street, Princeton, New Jersey. My dear Dr. Einstein, Mrs. Du Bois and I have received your autographed book with deep appreciation and will read it with pleasure and profit. I am venturing to enclose with this letter a statement on a case in which you may be interested. We are, sir, very sincerely yours, W.E.B. Du Bois. After Einstein volunteered to be a defense witness, and the case against Dr. Du Bois was subsequently dismissed by federal judge Matthew F. McGuire, Du Bois wrote again, November 29, 1951, Mr. Albert Einstein, 112 Mercer Street, Princeton, New Jersey. My dear Dr. Einstein, I write to express my deep appreciation of your generous offer to do anything that you could in the case brought against me by the Department of Justice. I am delighted that in the end it was not necessary to call upon you and interfere with your great work and needed leisure, but my thanks for your generous attitude is not less on that account. Mrs. Du Bois joins me in deep appreciation. Very sincerely yours, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Context of white supremacy. One more section to go. That was our first audio segment. Mel, spectacular effort. Our narrator, almost done. Many efforts here on the cow. She always does such phenomenal professional work. Plus, it's always nice when I do not have to read. The number to dial for the broadcast, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We're finishing the book today. It's not very big, so we are all done. One more segment to go. So be thinking, why did Dr. Welsing recommend that we check out this book? We're almost at the finish line, so, you know, why third-generation physician, general and child psychiatrist, who went to Germany to study, why would she want us to read this book? What lessons do you think she would want us to extract from this text? Major takeaways that folks have from the text, be thinking of those as well. One question that I wanted to ask, it seemed folks who said, hey, this guy sounds like Albert Einstein, sounds like some of these other race soldier hustlers, you know, who get out here, the Timothy Wise, Jane Elliott, their ilk, where he'll come out and say a few words and talk about the problem in a kind of highfalutin kind of way, and he will have a lot of black people, non-white people, who will become just enamored and just think he is just the coolest, sweetest, most special person ever. You know, he'll come and hang out with us and sit out on the stoop and talk it up and all the rest of it. That view is expressed by some folks, certainly see the logic. What would the response be to someone who says, well, wait a minute now, the whole reason, or one reason that we're reading this book, is that Albert Einstein is not thought of like Timothy Wise, Jane Elliott, John Brown, the Bradens who were mentioned. He's not thought of. In fact, they have pretty successfully redacted most of the mentions about his relationships or contact with Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, his commentary on racism at all. So he's not even thought of as a cool white person. When they bring up all the tons of John Browns and Jane Browns in history, Heather Heyer now, they don't mention Albert Einstein. So he's not thought of in that way at all. And then he was making these comments. By now, we're talking 70, 80 years ago, and he wasn't even born in this country, right? So being chased out of Nazi Germany, you know, hounded by the FBI, sounds like he had some sort of knowledge about J. Edgar Hoover. And they had all the McCarthyism and hauling folks in front of Congress and what are your views? Are you a patriot? Do you love this country? Make America great again? All that, you know. That he was doing this at a time when it was risky, you know, even to come out and be mealy-mouthed in your commentary on racism. Like, it could cause you, you know, a lot of problems. What would be the response to those who say that accusation that Albert Einstein was just another one of these fake so-called anti-racists out here trying to fool black people and make him think that he's slick and cool? What would be the response that just doesn't fit for his time period, regardless of what he had to say, how accurate it was or inaccurate it was to say anything at all, was super risky for that time period, even someone classified as white, and he's not remembered or thought of. It's not like they use his work to put him up and say, see, not all white people are racist. We got out. They don't do that, you know. Just if folks have any thoughts. Star 6-1, if you have any comments. One more section to go. Wrapping the text up today. Let's see. Folks who have a hand up thus far, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. one props to Mel, the narrator. Very great job, especially with the German translation. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. I don't know the issue she did for that. So that was great. Well, she does it as a professional. I feel like she needs help. So this could be her. She has a narrator's voice.
Your line is breaking up a little
great
bit. It's a little choppy. I'm not sure if it's a bad signal, but it's a little choppy.
Can I hear clear now?
It's still a little choppy. I'm not sure if it's a bad signal. I hope it's not me, but I don't know if it's a bad. Are you in a headset or just regular dial-in?
Yeah, I just got off the headset, so I'm talking to my phone.
I don't know. You want to try to hang up and dial back in, see if it's just we got a bad connection?
Oh, yeah, I could do that.
All right, we'll get Henry in Chicago back. In the meantime, I'll read one of the commentaries from folks who wrote it, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you're not able to dial untiljustice@gmail.com, if you're not able to dial. Yes, investor, he wrote it. My takeaway from the text is it demonstrates how racist man and racist woman use distraction tactically to avoid dealing with the real issue of racism, white supremacy. The demonizing of communism, socialism by U.S. authorities as the evil threat to the world provided racist man and racist woman with the distraction and excuse to terrorize non-white people individually, Robeson, Dubois, many Einstein, I reckon, and collectively, Korean War, Vietnam War, Mr. Fuller, Korean War veteran, worldwide for the next 75 years. It also shows how racist man, racist woman, racist child can turn allies into an enemy, Russia, seemingly in the blink of an eye if it serves their goals. Absolutely can do it in the next 5 minutes. Victims of racism, white supremacy, I think this strategy continues today when one looks at how the U.S. treats Cuba, Venezuela, and Brazil. Interesting. They do change things around, you know. It's all how we see things, what's going to be most beneficial for, you know, where things are proceeding at the current moment. Might drop a nuclear bomb on you today, and then we'll come help you rebuild the city tomorrow. Just depends. Let's see. We'll go back. We'll see if we have. All right. We'll try again. See if Henry in Chicago is sounding crystal. Let's see.
Can you hear me now?
Crystal. Let's make sure we give it up for Mel one more time. We could kind of hear, but just to make sure that it's crystal. Let's get it again for the narrator.
All right. So, Mel, want to give big props to Mel narration of this book, especially for the German accent of the German words that she pronounced. I thought that was incredible. And like I was expressing before, I don't know if she does this professionally, but this would be a nice side hustle for her because she has a nice narrator's voice. So big props to Mel. As far as the text, when it says that talks about the unreported meeting, the FBI unreported tracked meeting between Einstein and Wolfson. You know, I was thinking about that, and yeah, they may have probably outwitted the FBI on their meeting location, but I don't think for a second that they weren't tracking these two individuals, because they probably knew their whereabouts, and they probably knew, you know, that they were meeting at a particular place, but they just, I guess they couldn't get the wiretaps or the informants in time to kind of listen in on the conversation. But It's not that the FBI just, you know, didn't want to untrack it. They probably, you know, they probably just didn't have time to put the wiretaps in. But I'm pretty sure they have enough wiretaps on Robeson. Definitely, we read that before, and on Einstein. The Peekskill incident that was talked about was also reported in Dr. Horn's book on Robeson, on Chapter 7. Same thing, Horn has a little bit more detail on that incident with Robeson. But there was one that I went back and I read that part in Dr. Horn's book, and there was one major discrepancy, and it was I wouldn't say major, it was kind of minor, but, you know, still. So in the current book on page 123, they mentioned that Robeson's incomes fell from $100,000 to $6,000, his income. But Dr. Horn, on my book, in it looks like page 127, he states that Robeson's income went from $100,000 to $2,000. So I thought that was a pretty interesting, you know, discrepancy there, where the current author said he went down to $6,000, and Dr. Horn said he went down to $2,000. I'm more inclined to believe Dr. Horn because of the fact that, you know, the white powers that be, you know, really hated Robeson, so they probably tried to, you know, reduce his income to zero, if you ask me. On page 124, Einstein said he thought the South Africans should use Gandhi's tactics of passive resistance. Now, that was a fallacy there, because Gandhi didn't use the word passive resistance. He used nonviolent resistance. It wasn't passive, you know, at all. So same thing with Dr. King, more of a nonviolent resistance. So I don't know. I think that passive resistance is more of an oxymoron, if you ask me. The Lincoln speech in the appendix where they were talking about Einstein's writings. He wrote in this one sentence that I marked down, there is a separation of colored people from white people in the United States. There's no separation of colored people. There is a system of white supremacy against colored people that white people dominate, you know, but I don't see like a total separation. You know, now there's some areas that, you know, they may separate, you know, the Negroes from, you know, the white folks. But other than that, you know, I see a lot of areas where there's, you know, black and white people living in the area, but the only people that is suffering from the system is black people. And then I guess the separation is something of a, you know, of what Einstein is saying as kind of, you know, what the problem of racism in America is. But, you know, I don't know, his choice of words has kind of been, you know, very skeptical. And then lastly, you know, I don't think Einstein is in the class of, you know, a Tim Wise or a Jane Elliott, where he's profiting from being an anti-racist. I don't even think he claims to be an anti-racist. He just, you know, I guess he's just giving his opinions on it and just doesn't like it, I guess. But no evidence in this book shows me that, you know, he is, you know, a true anti-racist or anything like that. He speaks about racism, but, you know, that's about it. And even in his writings, I don't even think he's very serious about being an anti-racist, because if you look at the documents that was presented in that last chapter, you see that he has all these words in some of these letters that he, you know, has to these organizations like the National Urban League, but then he has like one paragraph to President Truman, who was the most powerful white person at the time on earth. And, you know, he's talking about this anti-lynching law, and he doesn't even use lynching. He doesn't use racism. He doesn't use white supremacy. He doesn't even use discrimination in that letter. So for me, it's like he's not even serious about being an anti-racist in his writings, you know. I mean, like, I would figure that the letter he wrote to the National Urban League, that would have been the letter he would have wrote to to President Truman, you know, since he is, like I said, he's the most powerful white on the earth, white man on the earth. And, you know, he could stop lynching in a second, you know, if he wanted to. But, you know, one paragraph with no words of racism or anything. So, but that's all I have. I'm in my line.
Important point. President Truman, stroke of a pen, can get things that you see that with President Trump all the time. Get things done. Just for the difference, this book, they say Robeson's income dropped to $6,000. Dr. Gerald Horn, just with us recently, in his book that we read previously, said his income dropped to $2,000. Now, just, you know, for folks, $4,000 is not that big a deal, especially if you're talking dropping all the way from $100,000. Yes, about the same, but not quite. So I just did the inflation calculator, so I'm just doing a rough estimate, 1940, we'll say. Could be worse. Could back it up a year or two. $4,000, 1940, today's value, that would be $73,255. So that is a substantial difference, even to drop from 6 to 2. I mean, unless you think $75,000 is, you know, no big deal today times. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Non-Clemson grad, maybe even Miss C.
Yep, both of us are here. Not sure if Miss C will speak with you in a moment. But I do want to give a shout out to Mel as well. When me and my wife read this book, we read it out loud to each other, and I don't know about other people when they read out loud. Me personally, I have a hard time reading words and not messing up from time to time. And Mel, what she reads is just reads perfect. So real professional, real impressive work by Mel. In reference to Dr. Welsing, firstly, I have a hard time wondering why she recommended this book the way she did. But there are some lessons to be learned from it, for example, about how the U.S. government feels when anyone tries to act in a manner that is against the system of racism. Page 123, when it talks about the, in the notes section in particular, the FBI attempted to assassinate Robeson at least four times that we know of. You know, obviously within the last couple of weeks, there's been a whole bunch of random, you know, lynchings where, you know, apparently a black person is found in a tree and they just pronounced it a suicide. And obviously there was the one, and then you juxtapose that to the most recent one with the man who was about to get lynched and someone came and, you know, the white people, white allies, as they like to call themselves, came in and stopped that from happening. It just really, at least to me, shows that connection between, you know, what white people say is happening and what they're actually doing when certain things tend to happen, especially when black people are harmed and killed and we just don't know how it happened. Or we're left with the simple ideas. Let's see. Einstein was invited to be president of Israel. That was on page 124, paragraph 2. I find that amazing. What was so amazing about Einstein that he was just simply invited to be president of a country? That was just amazing to me. And, you know, maybe he just simply wasn't that kind of person. But I think that's kind of, you know, kind of interesting as well, too, because, you know, when people talk about Israel now, you know, even though this is supposed to be the land of the people who were the survivors of the Holocaust, you know, you juxtapose that to how they treat the people of Palestine, I'm a little confused. I'm a little confused by that sometimes. Let's see. Einstein recommended nonviolence as a tactic in the civil rights era. You know, this, you know, maybe a decade later or so, but this is not too far from when we end up in the Robert F. Williams era, and of course he said that nonviolent stuff will get you killed. You know, maybe, obviously Einstein escaped the Holocaust because, you know, he left, I think, but, you know, sometime around the 30s, and he went back to a citizenship. So for the most part, Einstein basically was just away from the violence that was happening in Germany at the time. So maybe from his perspective, you know, maybe it's easy to take that nonviolent stance. But for the people who were the victims of the Holocaust during that time, nonviolence was, to a certain degree, maybe forced upon them, whether, you know, willingly or unwillingly, and obviously a lot of people ended up, you know, dead. Let's see, page 126, the world was unable to prevent the execution by electrocution of Willie McGee back in 1951. To me, that's just, you know, freaking unfortunate. You know, I don't really see how it's any different than today. Recently, my wife and I were watching reruns of The Boondocks, and there was a particular episode where a black man was going to be executed in that particular episode. And by the grace of God, well, at least in that episode, Huey sent in a letter to the governor's office out in the governor's gay sexual lover or something like that, and it stopped the execution of the person in the episode. And Shabazz was his name, Shabazz. And I juxtaposed that a little bit to this whole Willie McGee situation. Unfortunately, he didn't get the luck of, well, yeah, he was lucky enough to get his execution pardon twice right before, unfortunately, they got him the third time, even after all the effort, not just from inside the country, but also outside the country from other countries to try to keep him from being executed. Even though everyone clearly understood at the time that this man didn't commit the act that he was accused of. Let's see. Einstein and Robeson had different ways of resisting congressional investigation. Einstein simply answered the questions he thought were appropriate. Robeson simply remained quiet. This is on page 127 in the notes section. This is very interesting because, you know, you constantly hear about the idea that, you know, if you're ever arrested or anything like that, the most important thing you can do is be quiet. Now, I do find it interesting that Einstein felt, for whatever reason, that there were questions that he could answer and not have those answers used against him in a court of law. Robeson, maybe because he was a black man, understood that, and of course, Robeson was a lawyer as well, too, understood that when you say something, it could absolutely be used to crucify you and end your life and put you in jail for the rest of your life. You know, there's a book by an Ohio professor named Dr. James Jones, and he wrote a book called You Have the Right to Remain Innocent. And this is the white male, by the way. And, you know, realizing that he commits racism, but one of the things he constantly talks about is the idea that under no circumstances, you know, should you ever, 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 ever talk to the police and let the court and let your lawyer handle all your talking, because the most seemingly benign thing can get you in trouble and end you in jail, so it's just not worth taking the risk. You know, obviously the police are already acting in a manner that is just detrimental to your life. At the very least, you shouldn't add to that by, you know, adding words that can be used to get you in jail. Let's see. Men are greedy, but we've achieved this day with stealing. We've achieved this world with stealing is relatively rare. This is on page 144. To me, I just found this. Einstein said this. That was like, what is he talking about? You know, the United States, he talked about, at least, you know, throughout the book, it seemed like he really relies on the idea of the United States, you know, this country where people are created equal, that they're able to actually do something about them, you know, the misdeeds of the world and other places and stuff like that. And, of course, you know, any black person is paying attention, I would hope they are to a certain degree, you know, America is a place that stole entire peoples and continents. So this idea that Einstein is getting at is just, you know, at least to me, a little dubious and a little confusing as well, too. And maybe part of the reason why, you know, maybe some of the people who are listening to this book right now have a little bit of misgivings about this idea that Einstein was this person who really cared to do something about racism. At the very least, Einstein was this genius that people, you know, professed him to be. I don't think it's unreasonable for a genius to clearly see that the United States is a constant hypocritical contradiction. And then let's see on page 145, the founding fathers of this country who once wrote, "All men are created equal." You know, recently a meme appeared online. I think it's about what do I do, but nevertheless, it's kind of truthful. We live in a country, going back to that last statement, we live in a country where, you know, people are saying hypocritical things like "all lives matter," But at the same time, based on, you know, living in a country where the Founding Fathers wrote all men are created equal, you know, like I said, Einstein is a genius, at least that's what he is called, or that's how he's remembered. And even with all men being created equal, yeah, he talked a little bit about racism and stuff like that, but it's like, I don't believe it either. Personally, I don't believe it. Given that, and Mr. C has nothing to add, at least right now, so I'm behind.
Much obliged. That is a hoot to hear that they are Miss C and non-Clemson grad reading the book aloud to each other. Fantastic counter-racist activity. Two huge thumbs up. Reading more important than watching television. Other folks, that's a good point. Paul Robeson studying law, so I'm not just speaking as some, you know, mumbling idiot who doesn't understand words matter. Especially when you're talking to, you know, white people. Congressional white people at that. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally.
Can I be heard?
The black African.
Thank you, sir. I get to your question. It's difficult for me to say that he's like the Tim Wises, because I haven't heard him say anything particularly profound or particularly like what those types of people say. I mean, he does use like confusing language a lot, but I think he's as dangerous, because I think just with today's reading, like I think they described some of the people saying that he had no racist bone in his body. I think that was during the maybe it was during the definition portion when you were playing the thing, or I can't remember. I think he's as dangerous. It sounds like a lot of black people thought that he wasn't a racist, even though he's a white person, and, you know, they walked with him, held hands with him. So I'm not sure if maybe it does matter, but I feel like he's as dangerous. I don't know. Like, I really don't find Einstein interesting in this book. I don't find anything that he says interesting. What I did find interesting in this book was the accounts of the school of Princeton and some of the racists there, and also in today's reading, one of the minimization of black people's as fighters, as like warriors, and also their contributions, I guess, in this particular war, like World War II. I think they said the statistic that they threw was that 1 million black people, American black people, were involved in the war, but only 5% saw battle, something like that. But they don't say what their contribution was. I know a lot of people had like massive contributions. And I also know like a lot of, I've read and I've seen documentaries of black people, like even volunteering to go fight in like Ethiopia to fight against Mussolini. Just like as a side note, my so-called family's from Southern Africa, my grandfather fought in World War II. I didn't know. I saw pictures of him in uniform and also him being trained by a lot of white people. He told me that he was in North Africa. He told me that he was in Italy. I think the minimization of black people fighting in World War II, I thought that was troubling. I think it was the first reading that I was listening to in the archives. And I think that Thomas from New York, he has something interesting. Like, it piqued my interest, because I guess I've worked in some of these. He said like that he was surprised at like how people take Einstein to be a genius and whatnot, and because a lot of his work has been a failure or has been viewed as a failure. But from my working experience and some of these, I think I've heard Thomas talk about DARPA, and a lot of money goes there and a lot of things fail. Like the majority of them fail, leading scientific things. And but they're always like, I don't want to say a metaphor. I guess it would be like pushing the envelope or something like that. Yeah, but they're always attempting new things, new configurations, new all kinds of things. And so so I just thought that that was interesting. And like I worked on a project that ended up failing, but the project had been going on for like about 8 years before I got there, and then I had worked on it 4 years, and then the white people, like the scientists and engineers, they just shrugged their shoulders, like, oh, well, I guess we'll be assigned to this other project and whatnot. But I wouldn't take it that seriously that what he did was a failure. I think it's just that, how can I put it? Like, yeah, they do experiments. They do experiments, let me just say that. And then also, I know that he was very important, from what I've read, in really promoting the universe as a physical entity, like as almost like a physical mechanical entity that can be sort of like measured and really dissected and understood. That's what I think he's really, really revered for. And you know, like things having mass and matter, that kind of thing, circumference. So he's, I think that's some of the things that he's known for, and some of the things that I think a lot of white people appreciate him for, is that he made the universe, which I don't know if it's physical or not, you know, I don't know anything about that, but because he presented it as a physical thing that can be controlled, I think he makes a lot of white people happy, because it's to them, okay, now I can control this. I can measure this. I can do this, that kind of stuff. Also, yeah, great reading by Mel, but I this is just to ask, not a suggestion or anything. Not her readings, but when she's giving her commentary, I'm a little bit slow. So she says like a lot of great stuff. I think she speaks quickly, but if I don't mind her speaking quickly, but like if, when she goes to like another point, it would be great if she like paused. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just, I'm just weird. But like sometimes it's like, it's difficult for me to tell when she's gone from like one point to another. So then I'm trying to figure out that kind of thing. I don't know if what I'm saying makes sense or if it's stupid or cruel. But yeah, thank you to Mel, and thank you, Gus. Thank you.
Ooh. Much obliged. The Black African. Great points. I believe Mel is with us, so she can, you know, speak for herself. But I suspect she can handle that much easier than accusations of being a white person who has infiltrated the Cows group to do some voice work, like slowing down. I think she can handle that. And I think I did tell her a few weeks back, she called in, not for the narration. Her rate of narration has been excellent. But this was just calling in for commentary, as you just said. She called in a few weeks back, and I said, wow. Slow down. Woo! You are rolling like she can. I think sometimes people just get excited or whatever, or some people speak a little bit faster. But yeah, I think I have noted that myself, and not a bad criticism at all. I think I appreciate it, because we all want to, you know, get as much information as we can. Still learning. Let's see. Other folks that we have missed, if you have commentary, proceed.
I've heard that.
Thomas in New York?
Absolutely. Albert Einstein, I wonder why Dr. Welsing wanted us to read this book. I didn't get anything from it. But Albert Einstein, I think, is a very refined racist. Probably the architect of whiteness studies on the low, you know. Just so refined. As, you know, it seems like he was the architect of defining the U.S. role in the United Nations. You know, it seems like he had a voice when it came to other things. His civil rights advocacy was fraudulent because we had civil rights since 1866 that he doesn't demand the U.S. recognizes in his speeches. Asked to be the president of Israel, so he was a Zionist. Zionism is Jewish for colonialism. Israel was and still is stolen land that's occupied to this day by Jews, you know, that didn't belong here. So, I mean, how could you be for the blacks? Also, you're for the Negroes, but against the Arabs. I saw read an article on where he's against even the lighter brown to yellow Chinese people. He said, and I'll quote, "It would be a pity if these Chinese supplants or other races, if the Chinese supplant or other races for the likes of us mere thought is unspeakably dreary, dark, dreary. Just, you know, how could, you know, you like these dark-skinned Negroes, but you don't like the squinty-eyed, almost white Chinese people. It's just, you know, and the Arabs, you know, who, you know, your people are over there bombing and taking land from. I believe the Jews themselves were not classified as white men until the 1950s, maybe the late 40s. You did a show on it where someone came in and they explained that. And they used the census as the, you know, showing when they were Jewish Americans, then they were just white, you know. So he says, I quote, "A disease, racism is a disease of white people." He wasn't a white person yet, you know, so he didn't get the chance to get the disease. And they seem to like that disease. So, you know, to me, Jews like Albert Einstein have always tricked black people. They use a sales tactic. It's called the principle of reciprocity. And in sales psychology, it's when you give someone something and they feel compelled to give you something back in return. They give us a little something, and then we feel like we owe them, and we give them a lot in return, and, you know, we never get anything back for that, you know. It's a very slick tactic that they use, and they use it against us almost exclusively, and we, for some reason, have an epiphany for these people. But, I just don't get why Dr. Welsing said to look at this book, you know, unless she, for some reason, felt like Albert Einstein wasn't a racist, maybe, or she thought that he was so refined that it was something that we should look at. And she always speaks, I would say, very highly of the Jews in Germany. I know she went over there, but, I mean, you know, since they've been white people, they haven't been good to us at all. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. So we do have one more audio segment, so I'll share my commentary and we might get to that, and then we'll be all done for this section. Let's see, some of the things, or for the book session and the book. Yeah, I agree with Henry in Chicago. Like it says when they talks about this so-called secret meeting between Robeson and J. Edgar Hoover, that they, you know, outwitted him this time. They didn't even know. Like, I mean, they were tracking Robeson relentlessly for almost the duration of his time on the planet. So, even if they didn't have a person like hiding in the closet exactly, like, I'm pretty sure they were not that far off the trail. It says, they talked about the Peekskill mob, white terrorism. We talked about that. Talk about looting and anarchy in the streets. Usual suspects. At the bottom, I thought this footnote was... Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, next page. Next page. So at the bottom, there's a footnote talking about all of this. And it reads, under the headline, was FBI involved in attempts to kill Paul Robeson? An article by J.J. Johnson in the newspaper The Daily World, October 25th, 1979, reported that Paul Robeson's son, Paul Jr., after reviewing some 3,500 documents, that's what I mean about, you know, I don't think they were that far off the trail. I mean, 3,500 pieces of paper, all about one Negro. In the FBI's file on his father, found that there were at least four occasions in 1946, 1955, and twice in 1958 when cars in which his father was being transported were sabotaged. We read about one of them, or I just read that section from the book when Dr. Horn was with us on the program. They had loosened the bolts, and then they just put the hubcap back on so that the car, I mean, the tire could go flying off, and then, you know, you swerve into a truck or a tree or fly off a bridge or whatever it is. But four times when cars in which his father was being transported were sabotaged, both the cars and drivers in each case were under FBI surveillance. They weren't very far behind. If Robeson and Einstein did have this so-called secret meet, they were probably outside jimmying the lock on the car and putting sugar in the gas tank and everything else. Let's see. Oh, so they mentioned a collection of... Later on, in response to Einstein's questions, Robeson reported on his efforts to resist McCarthyism at home, as well as the intensifying freedom struggle in South Africa. Einstein said he thought that the South Africans should use Gandhi's tactic of passive resistance, and 8 years before the student sit-ins launched the civil rights movement, Einstein argued that black Americans, too, should adopt nonviolence as their strategy. I just wanted to point out that Bishop Desmond Tutu, Nobel Peace Prize winner, I don't think you could find a better global ambassador for so-called nonviolence, said in the documentary film Witness to Apartheid that nonviolence failed. No other way to put it. We tried. It failed. We still have the same problems. It did not solve the problem. I think the same could be said here. Great reference, that nonviolence stuff will get you killed. Mr. Cobbs was a member of SNCC, the author of that book, guest on the program back in 2014. Whew. Let's see. Failed all the way around, not so-called nonviolent. And I'm even in a system of racism, white supremacy. I mean, you just had to flee Nazi Germany. I look at anybody a little crooked in a system of total terrorism. Like, what you Negroes need to do is dedicate yourselves to being nonviolent. Like, anyway, he says, I've certainly not found anything to be impressed by Mr. Einstein. On January 31st, 1951, he says, honest people constitute a hopeless minority. That is one. I would say, hey, we are in a system of racism, white supremacy, primarily operated by deception. So that should not be surprising at all. In fact, we should all keep that in mind. Let's see. Speaking of minorities, it seems to be a universal fact that minorities, especially when they're individuals, are recognizable because of physical differences, are treated by majorities among whom they live as an inferior class. Now, all of that, he would get the buckets and buckets of words. That's why I said, I mean, he's not really saying a whole lot. Like, I mean, I guess, like, okay, it's 1940s, 1950s, and... You know, just had to get out of Germany and McCarthyism, the Red Scare. You could be hauled into Congress and questioned and all that. Yeah, I'm still not. And all of that minorities, and I don't even know who you're talking about. Like, you still have a whole lot of that today. Majorities are doing this against the minorities. Man, make it plain. Yeah, and then he goes into talking about, like, the contributions. This is in his letter addressed to the inauguration of the Wall of Fame. And so he's talking about the Negro's wonderful songs and choirs, his fine contribution in the realm of art. That's what the Negro has contributed to America, nothing else. That's another one. Like when people talk about black people and the only contributions that they can think of, oh, the tunes. I love the darkies music. That's all you can think of. Dance, music, song, that's it. Twerking, that's what we've contributed to the U.S. You can't think of anything else. God, they don't even throw peanut butter in. They normally at least get that one. Like, ah, yes, we give you Dr. Cara. Yes, yes, yes. Peanut butter. Everybody loves Jiffy. That's all we contributed. Guy, and you are a genius at an Ivy League institution with all of these books and information, and all we've done is sing and jigger and polite Paul with a wheelbarrow of apples. Next. And he has some tacky metaphors, too. He says, oh, man, talk about, yeah, some of this. Now, I will add, one of the times when Dr. Welsing spoke about this book, I wasn't sure if she had actually read it. It sounded like she just acquired the book. So it might have been one of those type of things where, oh, I just got this. This looks interesting, but I haven't really read it yet to see, you know, what's actually in it. Maybe she had, maybe she hadn't. Anyway, but he said a whole lot of things. That, I mean, a lot of it is buckets and buckets of words. And then sometimes it was just like, what are you talking about? Like, man, I'd rather, where's Jane Elliott? He said, men are also greedy. Yet we have achieved a state in which stealing is relatively rare. I don't know when that is, where, what time period, what part of the earth, like where is it that they don't have locks? They don't have locks on the cash registers, they don't lock the doors, they don't have any safes, no Alexa, no home security footage. Where is that place at? I haven't been there. I would like to go. No idea what he thought. He's saying this at a time where black people are being lynched on a regular basis. He's having to write and complain about it. That counts as a theft right there. You have stolen someone's very life. Continuing. Asked to be the president of Israel. This is someone who has quite a bit of power. I mean, he's got security clearance with the Navy, pen pals with presidents, Ivy League colleagues probably all across the world, asked to be the, I mean, wow, the amount of influence, like he could, the people who are like, hey man, I don't care, like you holding hands with black people, sitting on the stoop, writing a, you know, cutesy little note to President Truman where you don't even say discrimination or privilege or none of that nonsense jargon, you don't even do that. You have all this power and influence. Like, man, you could have done a lot more for those black people on Witherspoon Street in New Jersey. Like, man, a lot more than just, you give me a few gumdrops and I, like, come on, man. What did Pharaoh Winfrey, the most you can do, she was talking about white people, admitted white supremacists, the most we can do is the least we can do. It doesn't sound like Albert Einstein did very much at all. Buckets and buckets of words. Let's see. Last one. In the Q&A, he gets asked, do you feel the scientists who gave us the atomic bomb should be held morally responsible for any destruction wrought by the bomb? I was thinking, now, isn't he one of the scientists? He had security clearance? If I'm wrong, you know, set me straight. But he gives his answer. He says, no. It is true that advances in physics have made possible, he's responsible for, have made possible the application of scientific discoveries for technical and military purposes. He's got Navy clearance, that's military, which engenders great danger. The responsibility, however, lies with those who make use of these new discoveries rather than with those who contribute to the progress of science, with the politicians rather than the scientists. I'm not to blame. That's what that sounds like to me. A whole lot of highfalutin buckets of words to, I'm not to blame. It's not my fault. Mm-mm. I didn't do it. It was them, you know. I just tinker around, you know, with my test tubes and stuff. I get a microscope from now and everybody, oh, no, I didn't, nothing to do with that. Are you serious? That's not, to me, that's like standard white move. Like, yeah, I might have been tangentially, but, you know, not. That's what's happening right now with the Jeffrey Epstein. I might have, you know, we sat together at a restaurant one time, but I didn't really know him. Like, we didn't hang out together. What are you talking about? I didn't have anything to do with that, like putting any projects together. I don't know these people. Anyway, we have one more session, and then we are done with the book. Everybody satisfied? Or I guess it doesn't really matter because this is going to be kind of a shorter session, so we'll have time once the session concludes. You can write it down. We'll get to it. But anything folks need to get in right now? We'll assume folks are satisfied for the time being. Either way, again, this is a short follow-up, so write it down. Make sure you don't forget. We will be promptly back for our final thoughts on this text. Roger Taylor, black male, Fred Jerome, suspected racist, Einstein on race and racism. This is our final session. We can be thinking about why Dr. Welsing, what does she want us to get from this book as we wrap things up?
Chapter 2. From Einstein's FBI file on civil rights. American Crusade to End Lynching. The ACEL items in Einstein's FBI file begin with a report from Army Intelligence, G2, described by the FBI as a completely reliable source. When in Washington, the delegation planned to call on the White House and national figures to demand action by the administration. A parade was scheduled to be led by colored and white veterans who were to march to the Lincoln Memorial, where a national religious ceremony would be held and persons who had escaped lynch mobs were to be presented. Dr. Albert Einstein was scheduled to appear. As with most of Einstein's political activities, the FBI's reports on ACEL rely heavily on news stories and other published material. The Philadelphia Inquirer, dated September 23, 1946, stated, Einstein wrote a letter to President Harry S. Truman assailing lynching. This letter was supposed to be delivered to President Truman by a group headed by Paul Robeson. The People's Voice, dated October 5, 1946, stated that, in part, that Einstein and Paul Robeson were co-chairmen of the ACEL. The three-point program for the ACEL included 1. Apprehension and punishment of all lynchers, 2. Passage of a federal anti-lynching law, 3. Removal of Mississippi Senator Theodore Bilbo. Dr. Albert Einstein has been selected as co-chairman with Paul Robeson of the Crusade. A report in the September 14, 1946 issue of the Baltimore Afro-American states that a 100-day crusade to end lynching would begin in Washington, D.C. with a huge rally on September 23rd. In the afternoon, delegations will be appointed to confer with government officials about definite programs to stop lynching. The ACEL pamphlet states, lynching cannot be permitted to continue unchecked in a nation founded upon justice and equality. America must rid itself of the crime of unpunished lynching. Signers, morally indignant over this lawless violence, include Albert Einstein. Although Hoover frequently asserted that the Bureau was nothing more or less than a fact collection agency, the FBI's report on the American Crusade to End Lynching declared, in view of some of the endorsers, this crusade has all the earmarks of another communist attempt to instill racial agitation. The above information is evaluated in this report as having been received from a usually reliable source whose information was probably true. A subsequent entry on the ACEL states, Paul Robeson, who has a long record of communist affiliations, was the moving spirit in what was known as the American Crusade to End Lynching, and organized a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C. for September 23, 1946. This venture was actively supported by the communist press. In a harbinger of hundreds, if not thousands, of FBI reports to come, One entry on the ACEL concludes by labeling the group with a tagline that summarizes the Bureau's view of civil rights protests generally. Foreign-inspired education among the American Negroes. Internal security C for communist. Defense of the Scottsboro Nine. On July 5, 1931, Einstein, Thomas Mann, Leon Furchtwanger, and several others formed a German committee in support of Dreiser's committee to save nine Negroes at Scottsboro, Alabama, from the electric chair. Dreiser's committee refers to Nobelist author Theodore Dreiser, whose subversive activities included defense of the Scottsboro defendants. The last of the Scottsboro defendants to go free was Hayward Patterson, who escaped to Michigan in 1948 after serving 17 years in Alabama prisons on what the world knew were false charges. In 1950, Michigan's governor, G. Menin Williams, refused to extradite Patterson back to Alabama. Campaign to Save Sam Buchanan. The Daily Worker of October 2, 1943, carried an article entitled Final Hearing Set on Buchanan Fight, with the subheading, Einstein Joins Defense to Halt Negro Extradition. The article stated in part that Professor Albert Einstein, the world-renowned scientist, was the latest to add his name to those battling to save Sam Buchanan, 34-year-old Negro who had served 14 years on the chain gang in Georgia for stealing a pack of cigarettes, and that the National Federation for the Constitutional Liberties was conducting the fight to save Buchanan. After months of protest, a New Jersey judge freed Buchanan. The Defense of Willie McGee. The Daily Worker of March 27, 1951, described Willie McGee as a Mississippi Negro victim of a rape frame-up who was seeking an appeal of a death sentence before the U.S. Supreme Court. According to the Worker of April 22, 1951, Einstein stated in part, "In the face of the evidence, any unprejudiced human being must find it difficult to believe that this man really committed the rape of which he has been accused. Moreover, the punishment must appear unnaturally harsh to anyone with any sense of justice." Informant blacked out advised that Willie McGee was a Negro of convicted rape and executed in the state of Mississippi for his crime. The Defense of the Trenton Six. The Trenton Six refers to the trial and conviction of six Negroes accused of killing William Horner, a Trenton, New Jersey merchant. According to, informant's name blacked out, the defendants were represented by the Civil Rights Congress, and the case has been of interest to the Communist Party of New Jersey. The Worker, dated June 5, 1950, quote, "Einstein and 14 other individuals denounced the court attempts to deprive the Trenton Six of defense by naming attorneys of their own choice and advocating that the public help in the struggle to preserve the Bill of Rights," unquote. Defense Fund for Negro Citizens. A letter from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Legal Defense and Educational Fund, dated August 14, 1943, addressed to Mr. Ernest Hemingway, enclosed a statement signed by more than 100 leaders in almost every field of American life, an appeal to the addressee to contribute to the establishment of a vitally necessary defense fund to safeguard the rights of the Negro citizens. The signers of this petition included Albert Einstein. Civil Rights Congress, CRC. An article in The Daily Worker, dated December 15, 1948, entitled Crusade to Capital on January 18th Will Urge Civil Rights Laws, stated the CRC announced that thousands of people would come to Washington in a gigantic freedom crusade to demand payment of Truman's election campaign promissory notes on civil rights legislation. Sponsors of the Freedom Crusade included Einstein and others. National Committee to Oust Bilbo. Informant's name blacked out. Furnished the Bureau with literature distributed by the National Committee to Oust Bilbo, sponsored by the Civil Rights Congress. Included in this material was a letter dated December 4, 1946, signed by Quentin Reynolds and Vincent Sheehan. The names of 55 members of this committee were set out, including that of Albert Einstein. The Freedom Crusade. The Civil Rights Congress announced that thousands of people would come to Washington on January 8th to demand payment of the election campaign promissory notes on civil rights legislation. The conference would be held at the AFL's Laborer Auditorium in Washington. Sponsors of the conference and the Freedom Crusade included Dr. Albert Einstein and others. Southern Conference on Human Welfare. The Southern Patriot of March 1950 announced that the Southern Conference Educational Fund will hold a South-wide conference on discrimination in higher education in Atlanta University, April 8th. The New Jersey sponsors of the conference included the name of Albert Einstein. Council on African Affairs, CAA. According to the Daily Worker, dated April 22, 1947, in an article captioned, "Einstein says liberation of colonies urgently needed," Professor Einstein sent greetings to Max Jurgen, executive director of the Council on African Affairs, on April 21, 1947, and said, in part, quote, "No reliable or lasting peace will be possible without the political and economic emancipation of the subdued and exploited African and colonial people," unquote. Dinner to Honor W.E.B. Du Bois. Counterattack, a weekly newsletter published by the American Business Consultants, Inc. of New York City on February 16, 1951, stated that accused foreign agent Du Bois would be honored at a hotel banquet, that Dr. Du Bois' long record of pro-communist activities had not deterred approximately 200 people, referred to as notables in Communist Party press, from tendering him a banquet in honor of his 83rd birthday. That dinner was scheduled to be held at the Essex House in New York City on February 23rd. Counterattack stated further that notable sponsors included Dr. Albert Einstein, among others. The paper Freedom, dated February 1951, speaks of the Du Bois testimonial dinner. Quote, "More than 200 prominent individuals from all sections of the U.S., among them Dr. Albert Einstein, Mrs. Mary McLeod Bethune, Dr. Kurt Lee Mather, and Paul Robeson, are sponsoring the dinner to honor Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois on its 83rd birthday in the Colonnades Ballroom of the New York Essex House on February 23rd. When the Essex House canceled the dinner, it was held at Small Paradise, a Harlem nightclub.
I believe we are all done. Man, Einstein on race and racism. Well, I hope folks got something constructive from the book. I will agree with the person, I forgot which caller was, but they were saying that the information on Princeton, might have been the Black African, the information on Princeton, I appreciated a lot as well. But yeah, I'm not sure. It would have been interesting to check in with Dr. Welsing. Number one, I'd be getting, now, had you read this book when you recommended it? And then, what did she think? Albert Einstein, did you think he's some cool fellow? Were you impressed by what he had to say? And, you know, we don't have much stealing in the world now. And all the rest of this impressed you? Or his comparisons with what was happening in Nazi Germany? Like, I just would have been very curious to know what her thoughts were on the text, what lessons she learned. Yeah, I'd have been very curious, but definitely, let's see, I have to think, what would I use? The Princeton, definitely the Princeton information, and the fact that at the same time we're reading this book, they make the decision about taking down Woodrow Wilson's name and all of that. I tend to be mindful when I get cues from the universe about timing, but not in the top 10. Although I certainly appreciate reading a book with no typos, the index is accurate, etc. References, footnotes, all appreciated. The number is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Other folks, if you didn't get to share at all, you should definitely speak up. We have ample time, so there's no reason for you to be hanging out until the end. But go ahead and speak up if we missed you totally. If you have additional comments to share, all the folks who dialed in with us who had a hand up, line should be open. Any concluding thoughts to add in? Let's see. We'll nab the folks we missed totally. Retired firefighter should be with us.
Greetings, everyone.
Greetings.
Yes, sir. What I have been thinking about is, first of all, Albert Einstein, prior to him coming to this part of the world, was a world-renowned scientist under the global system of racism, white supremacy. He was actually sought after when the issues started in Germany. So he was very much welcomed by white people to come to this part of the world. It doesn't take a very smart person to understand why you would want somebody of his scientific magnitude to be here when, even before white people in this part of the world join in on a political conflict that became a physical one. And in turn, I think the reason why he was allowed to, quote unquote, get away with espousing some of his, well, espousing political understandings is because of what would be the fallout if they, you know, arrested him or something like that. Because most of the people, I'm not going to say both of the people, I would definitely say a lot of the physicists that constructed those two nuclear bombs and subsequently a nuclear armament afterwards were also quote-unquote white Jewish males who admired Albert Einstein. So I think even during that time that white people were, the white people in power were pretty much refined to have that understanding. Certainly once they was able to get that down to a manufacturing standpoint, they actually went after Robert Oppenheimer. He was literally thrown out of the equation of the developing more atomic bombs because he wasn't needed anymore. They already had the quote unquote secrets and the know-how and that sort of thing. And when it comes to Albert Einstein with non-white people, even today it doesn't take much for a white person to gain our favorable attention if that person shows us some attention by being courteous, by saying some things. There's a lot of things that white people say and don't say that they already know the solutions to the problems that we have better than what we have, better than what we understand. And they just use it to their own best interest for whatever reasons. I've heard different reasons on why by some of the callers that I think make sense. Because you get a lot of gratitude from non-white people, especially non-white black people. That still is a factor today. So those have been my thoughts in the entire reading regarding Albert Einstein and his quote-unquote relationship with non-white people who are racially classified as black. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Let's see, nabbing some of the other folks we missed totally. Our hardworking narrator, Mel, joining us once again, should be with us.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you for everyone also who enjoyed the narration. I hope to do more reading later, assuming the COVID doesn't get me, because apparently the people at my partner's job are now taking their 2 weeks off of work, which is a whole different story. And I will try to speak more clearly, but I am a recovering debate club student. So I think Dr. Welsing recommended this book because it, to me, it's an incredible display of how a so-called great intellect and all the possible well-meaning can be just completely wasted over a lifetime. Like, the lesson to victims to me is basically there's no amount of intelligence that makes white people not racist. That it's either there or it's not. It doesn't really, well, that kind of to me, that's what I got from it. But I also enjoyed the information about Princeton in the background in the book a lot, actually. For instance, the Cold War section, I really didn't know anything about before reading this. I will say, though, while I think that he did maybe have a lot to lose with regards to his citizenship and during McCarthyism and during a time when even some white people can't be white, fighting of racism to me is a life-absorbing effort. Not saying I practice it best, not at all. But I'm saying that because it is a life-taking effort, that sort of energy is what you have to put into it. And so the energy that Einstein seems to put into constructing an atom bomb, albeit from the side, it's like it's something for which he just passes off responsibility onto politicians to even do right with. So it's like a half energy even in that aspect. Like the amount of energy he put into making that bomb, it can't be the same amount of energy he put into these letters. Otherwise, that bomb would have never been finished. Also, to me, there's a lot of congratulatory four-wallism described. Like, he joins the CRC, the NAACP, just all the alphabet. And that sort of lends to a side theory that I had, which I don't think my partner agreed with so much, but he thought it was worth maybe mentioning. My first theory, maybe, is that he's just unknowing about the severity of the problem. He's just tuning out on these porches, but he's well-meaning, and he's scared about being deported. My second theory is that I have a feeling that Einstein could have been smart enough to predict where society was going, so that refinement, to some extent, is inevitable, and he sees that, and that he thinks he should write himself into history correctly, like literally writing himself into history, and put himself on these boards and committees in name so that his legacy could literally play both sides. I mean, he's not in any photos. He doesn't write any books about racism in case, you know, society happens to stay unrefined and lynching, you know, many people a week. But he does write enough letters so that somebody eventually comes along and writes a book about him to add, like, counter-racist to his resume. I think he's potentially an example of playing both sides. But I wrote another list of the things I thought that he could have done more of instead of these change.org petitions that he keeps writing. One, I think that he should have asked any of the presidents he was talking to fire J. Edgar Hoover. And generally, I think he could use more useful language in his writings. Like, Gus, I think you mentioned that he was using the term minority a lot in some of these letters. I noticed that, too, because, you know, white South African minorities are really struggling. But I was saying last week, I don't know why the irony of the founding fathers owning slaves but talking about freedom isn't even mentioned. To me, his letters read like he's just going to shame Americans into a system of justice that he can't even shame Germans into. Two, I think he should actually have threatened to go to more trials, not just boys, but go to everyone, just regular black men and women's trials. Every civil rights trial at the time needed to have a random Einstein letter or appearance. I know he was sick at times, but at least all the East Coast or New Jersey trials where black people were on death row, he should have been wheeled into. Three, like Thomas in New York said, I think that there's something to the fact that he doesn't address the racist comments against so-called Asian people that he made in his 20s that are not mentioned in this book at all, actually. Like, he was saying that they were industrious, filthy, obtuse people, often more like automatons than people, that China is a peculiar herd-like nation. But weirdly enough, he also wrote that the Japanese were pure souls, who were unostentatious, decent, and altogether very appealing, which to me is very Stoddard-like. I remember Stoddard having a weird appreciation for Japanese culture or the imperialist aspects of it. Four, I think he should be honest and study Germany and Nazis for us. I think I said that before. Before Welsing does it, you know, has to go do it. And just define the root of racism that isn't mingled with capitalism. Like, you study atoms, you theorize quantum theory before it even exists. Like, he theorized that what quantum theory was before it was even known as that. But he doesn't know why Hitler wants to hurt him. Like, even Stoddard has a theory about why white supremacy exists when it's not financially profitable. And so this sort of, oh, whites benefit from this and that, they don't always actually financially or materially benefit. To me, Welsing theory kind of supports that, the theory of color confrontation. Five, and I only have two more. Five, I think he should write more than 10 letters and speeches about racism so that the second part of this book was bigger. If I look at the actual notes for those letters that he's writing, he writes in 1931, 32, then 1940, then 1946 through 48. Also, it would have been nice to see if he wrote about black people before he leaves Germany and also before W.E.B. Du Bois starts writing to him. And also, at some point, take more photos. Like, you sit on a bunch of councils with Paul Robeson, and you sneak into his theater performances, which is weird because you walk around with all the kids in the neighborhood, but you only have one photo with him and maybe one with Du Bois. When I was looking for photos of him, I go through the first 26. I don't see any with, like, black people. And then there's one where it seems like he's teaching, maybe at the Lincoln College speech. And then my last point for right now is that let your housekeeper eat in the dining room. And I'm just trying to think of one thing, just one thing he did for the black people of Princeton in this book. Like, the porches seem to remain in danger into the cross-burning 1980s, apparently, unless I missed a large segment of his local efforts in Princeton. It's not four-wall organization. Like, maybe a letter he wrote in Princeton to someone else in Princeton or something like that. Maybe I missed it. But that's all for now.
Criticize the four-wallism. Our championship narrator, Mel, much obliged for the commentary. She wrote out a list. She spent 2 weeks now with her list of things Dr. Albert Einstein could have done that would have been more productive than four-wallism. Man. Dr. Welsing did say that. I think she said that a number of times on, like, this platform and elsewhere. All of that brain power of Albert Einstein, like, man, wasted. Should have had a much better grasp of the problem. If he did, he should have shared. And it should, as you said, it should not have been, Dr. Welsing's got to go over here and hang out. Let me break that down for you. I was right there, and I wasn't even paying attention. Like, man, all this is happening. I barely got out. Like, I should have been talking about this in advance, like, seeing this rise, and, oh, man, I need to make plans and all the rest of it. So, absolutely. And that point about playing both sides, maybe that's the case. There are a lot of non-white people who are confused about racism. Dr. Welsing said that all the time. Most non-white people, like 99%, she would put an exact figure on it, do not understand white supremacy racism. Maybe he was in that number. I don't know. You're in Nazi Germany, have to flee for your life, you aunt, relatives, all the rest. And then you come here where they're lynching black people all the time, and you're a genius, and you can't connect the dots, as Dr. Welsing would say. Kind of hard for me to think he gets it, or just he's confused that he doesn't get it. He's confused. He just has greatly underestimated all of this. But it could be the plan both sides. I could totally see that, where he wants to have his name down, like, wow, he was so progressive. He was working against race, and then he's, you know, lame. I'll join the NAACP, and I'll sneak in the back entrance, hold hands with some of the Negroes around the way, and sit out on the stoop with them. But, yeah, I'm not going to do anything much more than that. Like, I know how serious it is. I'm not going to be on the run again. I got a cushy spot here at Princeton. I aims to keep it. Let's see. Other folks, if you have comments, thoughts, especially if we missed you totally, do not wait till the last minute. We are all done Einstein on race and racism. Irie in Louisiana should be with us.
Hello, can you hear me well?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Well, good evening, everyone. You know, when it comes to intellectuals, we have to kind of think of them as we do celebrities. You know, they understand, especially when they're of superior intellectual strength, that they're in a spotlight of sorts and that people are looking to them to either, you know, criticize or mimic even. And then, you know, it gets to a certain point with intelligentsia that if they do too much to try to create a system of justice or bring attention to a system of injustice, their intelligence will be invalidated, and they can end up on the in the scourges of those societies that had them, you know, uplifted. And what Mel was saying about how he could have done more, you know, I think he understood maybe above anything that if he maybe did too much, he would no longer, again, he wouldn't be a part of the scholastic collective and would be probably booted out. And I'm sure there were people, you know, that discouraged him from doing too much, you know, and then also an example preceding him is Nikola Tesla, and Tesla wasn't even necessarily speaking out against racism and white supremacy. He was trying to make it where alternate current energy was free to the public, and that was enough to get him outed and basically dying as a pauper. So, you know, these intellectuals, we have to remember they're human beings, and even though they have these platforms, they're not going to particularly use it to the fullest degree, because at the end of it, for every individual on the planet, whether it be an animal or a plant, your soul survival is of your utmost importance more than a group, or especially a group of people to which you don't even really identify. And that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Much obliged, Irie. Survival, that is very common. That is a part of our biology, perhaps, you know, valuing survival. That is in Mr. Fuller's code book, that is one of the major errors we have made collectively, valuing survival over justice. Very important point in the text. Much obliged again, Irie. Important point in the code book text, I meant. Let's see. All right, so the other folks who don't, if we have not heard from you at all and you think you have comments, final comments, questions, major themes that you'll take away from the book, why did Dr. Welsing want us to read this text, anything else, feel free. Other folks who dialed in, so Henry in Chicago, the Black African, Miss C, non-Clemson grad, Thomas in New York, line should be open.
Can I be here?
Henry in Chicago.
All right, so I went back to the first part and listened to the recording that you had on the first session because, when you introduced this book, you had Dr. Welsing's recommendation of this book. And I guess it was in the context of the Elliot Rodgers discussion and how the media was trying to suppress the talk of racism. And so, you know, she had expressed that, you know, when you talk about racism, no matter how credentialed you are basically, you know, suppressed, you know, as somebody crazy. And that's why she, in this context, she suggested this book in regards to Einstein being a genius, but yet he still talked about racism. So in that vein, that's what I think Dr. Welsing had recommended this book. Now, obviously, you know, reading this book and examining this book, you know, he did talk about racism, but, you know, obviously we – and me, I didn't have no expectation of him being anti-racist. I mean, you know, that's, you know, that was, you know, pointed out in the book, you know, several times by me and many other people who read his book. But, you know, one of the things that Dr. Welsing and many others talk about is one of the key elements of racism is either or the acts of racism is either denying that it exists or not even talking about it. So that's what I took away of why Dr. Welsing had, you know, recommended this book. But that's all I have on in my life.
I guess that's one thought that the doctors did share, Welsing and Einstein, that this let's not talk about it must end. That was in the section we just read this here week. Let's not talk about it. First rule of Fight Club and racism, white supremacy. Don't talk about it. White people follow that rule relentlessly, it seems. Although this refinement area, you can have your Jane Elliott, Tim Wise, and many others, white privilege and all the rest of it, talking much like what we've read here for the past few 4 weeks exactly. You can talk about it in a way that is going to obfuscate and confound the victims. Other folks?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Let's see. The black African? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Some of the other folks have talked about, I think the retired firefighter was talking about this in terms of like the nuclear bomb or the atom bomb. Like scientists, I remember seeing this program, like a TV program, and it described, it was like based in Germany, I guess a little bit before Hitler got in, took power or was welcomed into power. And they described, there was a section where they described something called Jewish science, and they were talking about this nuclear one, and also the psychiatry and psychology. And I even think that, if I remember correctly, Dr. Welsing used to chastise, I think, Sigmund Freud for not talking about white supremacy, racism, and I think, like, I've been thinking about this because there's a lot of people that. This thing about Jewish people not being white or white at some point, white not at some point, and when I meet many of them or some of them that are interacting with other white people, I they're treated as white people. But I remember that book you had on that guy. What is that? That book, America Aflame. I think it was written by David Goldfield, and he was talking about how white people really have a lot of fights or even battles because of different so-called religious alignments or something like that. And I've noticed, like, white people, like, I've heard, I think white people, like, chastise the other white people that don't practice religious alignment of that particular time or something like that. And the Jewish people, I was thinking about it. I've heard two jokes, maybe they're racist jokes, maybe they're not, but I heard, I used to play a lot of rugby, and I was with a white male, and he was describing a father that, a racist joke that his father said. And he told me that his father said that you always need at least one Jew to win, like a rugby match. And so I'm like, and I started to think about it. I was like, whenever, like, the part of the world where I was, whenever they won, there was a Jewish person there. Like, I remember in 1995, Joel Stransky, I think another time that they won the World Cup rugby, I think there was a guy called Pankowski on there. I heard another racist, maybe it's not, whatever, Jewish joke. I was living with some white males. One was so-called Russian, and he had just sort of like arrived in the U.S. maybe like for about a year, and we're watching a soccer match, and he saw like a player on the TV screen, and he asked who that person was. And I was about to tell him who that person was. He had like an Armenian name, sort of like Dr. Kevorkian. I think his name was Mkhitaryan. And so the guy read the name and he said, "Oh, Mkhitaryan." And he said, "Oh, Armenian." And he said, "Oh, we hate Armenians." And so like I was listening to the cows then, so that piqued my interest. And so I was like, "Oh, why do you hate Armenians?" And he said, he said because they bar or they bargain or something like that, like they're basically like peddlers. And I said, "Oh, like because they're something like that." And then he said, "Yes." And he said, "We hate them more than Jews." So I remember laughing out loud and just cracking, like it was just like a, because I guess he was a lot less refined. And there was like a white person, another white guy. Who had a terrified look on his face. And so I'm looking in between them and like the Russian guy, less refined, just laughing out loud. And the white American guy just looking like terrified, like, oh, it was just a hilarious moment for me. But yeah, that's all I have to share. Thank you.
First rule, don't talk about racism. I suspect that might've been part of the apprehension. Like this guy, like, where is your code? Where is your refinement? What type of white man are you? Maybe I was wrong. Let's see. Other folks, if you have a thought, question.
Can I be heard?
Miss C, also with Non-Clemson Grad.
Yes. Hello. Hello, everyone. We're finally concluding the book. And I had mixed feelings about the book. I think I learned a lot about Princeton, as was commented on before. I learned a lot about Princeton University and Paul Robeson. I was surprised that nobody really talks about Paul Robeson. You would think during like Black History Month or any other day of the year that we would highlight, you know, such a key person, but I had never heard of him before prior to reading this book. So I think it will be interesting to, you know, continue reading further or looking into his biography. As far as why we should have read this, I think there's just a fascination among white people, especially with World War II in the Third Reich. One of the things I found interesting about this book was they talked about like the KKK and then the German migration, how the United States and the FBI, State Department, and other federal agencies were bringing former Nazis into the United States to, quote, help with the war on communism, which is just, it's just very interesting. You would have thought that the Nazis would have been persecuted and they, you know, anybody who shared this ideology would have been killed or jailed or ostracized forever. But one thing's for sure, that the ideology is still around, most likely in Germany, even though you can't say anything against Jewish people in Germany, but also in the United States. Like there's a large percentage of German people in the United States with roots, and I would probably guess that a lot of them still hold on to those to that ideology about being like a superior race, white supremacy. Maybe it gave rise to the Aryan Brotherhood. That's what I would probably say. And just living in 2020 right now, we're seeing a lot of suspected white supremacists calling any white person who I guess, sympathizes with non-white people, communists or commies. So maybe the name calling helps them to identify who is on code with white supremacy and who is off code and who should be punished. As far as today's reading, I just have a couple names to share. The first one is at the very end of the book itself. Harry Morton, the young kid, it says Harry would go over to Einstein's house sometimes. He would try to get answers from him for his homework, but Einstein couldn't get Harry's homework. So I'm assuming Harry was probably like, you know, fourth or fifth grade, and Einstein, this genius in math and science, was unable to assist Harry with just fundamental math. And this brings up a major divide among university professors. When you get your PhD and decide you want to go into the profession of teaching, they will funnel all their professors onto two tracks. You can either be a teaching professor or you can be a researching professor. So the difference is pure science or pure math versus applied science. A lot of young people, especially non-white black children, struggle with math because they're like, well, how am I going to use this? How can I apply this to my life? But what was interesting was a young black boy is trying to figure out applied math, his homework, applied math, fundamentals of math, and the genius was unable to help him. So I guess we would assume that Einstein was definitely a researching professor. He gets paid to do that, gets paid lots and lots of money to come up with white papers, to come up with published papers and books on what he's working on and do presentations and not really relate to the students. So it's just an interesting perspective to see, you know, a so-called researcher, professor, be able to relate to people to black people on a more so human level. And the last thing I want to bring up is in the document, this isn't a critique against, I'm assuming, the non-white black person who did an interview with Einstein. It's just constructive suggestion. Document H, it was the interview with Cheney Record and Cheney State Teaching College, or Teachers College. During the interview, the interviewer asked a lot of, all the questions were closed-ended questions, which when you ask a closed-ended question, you can get a yes, no, or a simple answer. Luckily, Einstein fleshed out his answers. However, as an interviewer or when you're talking to white people, it's best to ask more open-ended questions so they don't try to bypass your question by just giving you a yes or no. They have to be more clear and concise with their answers and actually think about your question versus just saying yes or no and moving on. There were a couple answers where Einstein just gave a straight no or a straight yes answer, but then he added a little bit more and elaborated on it. In document J, Peter A. Buckey, I'm not sure what his race was, but he also asked a open-ended question and a closed-ended question. So it's not a critique on the non-white black person who was interviewing Einstein, but if you're going to ask, if you're going to interview somebody of this stature, you know, you want to, or anybody at all, you want to think about your questions and put a lot of thought into them so you can get answers that would be more valuable versus like asking closed-ended questions. And with that, I will mute my line.
Refining our question asking. Love it. Miss C, non-Clemson grad, South Carolina. great comment here. I think lots of folks said they appreciated the information on Princeton, which I did as well. Like, well, maybe visit the campus. Maybe some of us will have offspring, and they might want to, you know, attend school there or what have you. And I'm like, oh, yeah, Jigger, Polite Paul, yes. Mm-hmm. Go see, what is it? Witherspoon, yes, Witherspoon Street, where they used to sit out on the stoop and all that. But great commentary from Missy. Did we miss anybody?
Can I be heard?
I thought so. Thomas in New York.
Yes. The Nazis coming to the United States to work in the government after the war. That's called Operation Paperclip. It's a lot of literature on it. White supremacists, we could take two that we're all familiar with. I think there'll be consensus. Donald Trump and George W. Bush, Katrina. Now, these two people, I think we would all classify as not even on the suspect list. However, both of them have multiple speeches about racism that if you read them, you wouldn't get that impression. I think Trump just did one not too long ago in front of a whole black audience. And so if you take those author takes those books, I mean, takes those speeches just on racism, you know, 50, 100 years from now and writes a book and, you know, takes those speeches and uses that as the basis of saying they're not a racist, you know, that could confuse people, you know, and that's one of the things, because in the era that Mr. Einstein lived in, not like there was social media accounts and microphones everywhere where you could be caught saying things behind closed doors. So who knows how he really felt outside of public. I can't accept a certified genius like Albert Einstein, who just left German Jewish concentration camp style racism in Germany, is ignorant about racism. You know, like, it's just, you know, he's just too smart. And the science, that's why I say, you know, he's kind of the archetype, the architect of the whiteness studies, you know, just play ignorant, but talk about it, you know, but, you know, you're ignorant, you know, when it counts. Scientifically, he's best known for the theory of relativity, and I say relativity is still a theory. It still hasn't been proven, you know, and it's a lot of books that challenge that theory. But if you like pi, you know, that's not a theory. That's considered scientific truth. So 3.14, you know, the circle to do the circle. Jews in America, for some reason, they have become the authority on racism, white supremacy, and you know, through the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ADL, you know, both Jewish organizations, which have the power. Only organizations I know that have the power to label someone a racist, white supremacist, you know. And, you know, it's just, I just think a lot of this, a lot of what they do, it comes from reading this book about him. Because, man, they've been doing this refinement for a long time on the homogenous group of white people known as Jews. But either or, it's the Princeton part that was interesting. Because I'm going to be honest, I lived in New Jersey my first 25 years, and I didn't know any black people lived in Princeton. So that was, I've been there a few times. I was like, well, black people live here, you know. So that was interesting. I think that was one of the points of the book, which just keeps ringing out in my head. Why is this this scientist, a world-renowned Nobel Prize-winning brainiac scientist, going down to the ghetto to play with little black kids, you know? Like, I find a lot of times people, geniuses, they have a lot of other things wrong with them, and, you know, pedophilia is just what keeps ringing in my head, you know, Einstein, Epstein, you know, like, just doesn't, you know, just fits their character. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
second Epstein reference in the broadcast. Shameful. Did we miss anybody? Any of those have commentary?
Here.
Oh, yes, ma'am. We can hear you. We can hear you.
Okay. I wanted to add, my list wasn't finished. I don't know. I don't have much more because my phone is dead. But I have two things I remember from my list were I think that he should have done more interviews with black newspapers. Like in the beginning of the book, it said that the Crisis newspaper by W.B. Du Bois did well with his interview. Like the publication got very popular after that. And in my opinion, he would be speaking to more and more black people, which as much as they're suppressing him, I feel like the information will eventually get around. And then I also think that this is another thing. I think there was a section, I believe in chapter 8 or 9, where he is selling war bonds for the president. Like he tells the president, I'm going to help you sell these war bonds to help support the war effort. And I was thinking he could have done more fundraising actually for war bonds for some black people. Like he could have sold a cup that he drank out of. He could have signed a whole bunch of books so black people could sell them down the years. You know, all the people in Woodstone got a book by Einstein. All of them made in bank. He could have sold all those photos that he didn't take that I thought he should have taken. But I also wanted to make like one last comment. One thing I think that Einstein, at least from what I heard, like a little bit in the scientific community, one thing that he was good at was assuming that certain ideas were true and then doing the math until the theory either made sense or it was disproven. So like he comes up with the theory of relativity by just sort of applying creative thinking to it. And then he assumes it's a thing and then he develops math equations for that assumption and he turns out correct. There is a term that he keeps using often in this book. He keeps saying, like, any right-thinking person, blah, 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 will think this or that if he thinks hard enough, any well-meaning person or something like that. But I'm thinking to myself, okay, but he's Jewish, so he's basically like a part-time white person in the 1940s. And I think that that's something, interestingly, that he and Elliot Rodgers actually have in common. Like, Elliot Rodgers is a very white-adjacent person, maybe admittedly so by himself, but possibly less so. But there does seem to be an internal conflict about that, at least with Elliot Rodgers. But I think one of the more interesting things to me in this book has been his lack of admitting to being considered a white man and calling himself a Jew while being fascinated by Walter White, you know, merely passing as white. But I think that I basically think a man that is this smart should assume the permanence of white supremacy and at the very least not tell potentially black readers to keep educating white people and attempting to attain humanity through argument. I couldn't see him writing to Roosevelt or when he was writing about the counter atom bomb program saying that we need to just educate these Nazis more. But that, like, to me, that's a strange fault in the logic that he's making. Like his theories and proposals, whether it was in all of these interviews or letters to black people, it's very strangely, it's just a strange set of suggestions to me. Like he does repeat over and over, we just have to educate, we just have to talk and talk. And we're here, this is 2020 and the cows is doing a show about his book. Like, where's the education? What did it do? Sorry, that's it.
Our narrator, excellent job, lengthy list of things that would have been much more constructive for Dr. Einstein to do with his time and energy. The pictures, I think that's a great one because that would have been worth some dollars. The photographs, going to court, I think also is a great one. If it, you know, the threat of him going to court for W.E.B. Du Bois was enough to get him all charges dropped and right on. He could have done that for the Trenton Six. That would have been a close one. And lots of Mr. McGee maybe could have got off. Like, lots of them. Just, I'm going to go, I don't even have to testify. I can just go hang out in the gallery. And, wow, that would have got worldwide attention. Like, wow, global physicist, you know, persecuted Jew in Nazi Germany, now at Princeton University, is at trial of Negroes accused of raping a white woman. More on page B. I mean, that'd have been headlines around the world. But a lot more that he could have done that would have been helpful. And, yeah, I agree. All of that nonsense about the education, I mean, come on. That's what I was saying before. Like, you were in Nazi Germany. that cannot sound logical. Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. The right thinking person would have made plans and seen what was happening in Germany and got out of there quicker. Yeah.
Can I make one more comment, though?
Thomas in New York.
Yes, very briefly, just to piggyback on with the Navigator, who did a great job.
Woo!
Seems like he had a fascination with Walter White, a person who was black that could have passed for white. And it seems like it was like a fascination. And man, why isn't he just saying, you know, screw those niggas and go over there where he's trying to go as a Jewish man? You know, he's trying to be white. And, you know, you have the opportunity and you're not taking it. You know, I think that was a fascination with him. Like, you know, he couldn't believe it. You know,
Silent Warrior. Wow. Get our obligatory timestamp so it is a hair before 5 a.m. Norway time. Silent Warrior hanging in with us for the conclusion of our book club this week. You are with us, sir.
Thank you very much. I just woke up and I realized I could catch, went on Facebook and saw that you guys were at it. I have to agree with what the narrator said, and I'll be re-listening to a lot of the discussion here to catch some of the code that you guys are putting out. But my conclusion is also the same, that he is not doing a lot to help. He could have done more. In page 145, he talks about black people as descended from ancestors who, as protection against the destructive action of the radiation of the tropical sun, gained a more thoroughly pigmented skin than those whose ancestors lived in countries farther from the equator. I wrote that he had a chance to recognize some down on genetic theory. He could have come up with Dr. Welton's theory, because he's there at least recognizing the difference in skin color. And earlier he talks about people must have the courage to set an example by word and deed as a way to this. What can a man of goodwill do to combat this deeply rooted prejudice? Must have courage to set an example by word and deed, and must watch lest his children become influenced by this racial bias. And I'm wondering, is that him stating what his personal code is, that he himself will set a good example? That's why he's walking down the street and patting the black children on the head and sitting on the porches of the black people. He's trying not to be racist himself, but in fact he is, because he's not informing black people about what's happening when they're not around, and what kind of discussions are happening. I actually felt that Dr. Wilson wanted us to read this book so that we could compare him with Robeson and Du Bois. And that effect has been reached, because I now want to learn more about those two black men that fought against white supremacy. And it shows me that one of the most untouchable persons being classified as white, being your ally, still doesn't help you. And they decide how much or not they want to get involved in counter-racism work. So if Einstein won't do it, who will? Because he's the one that helped develop the bomb. So you know white people are not going to try and not take him out totally. They're not going to revoke his white status that quickly. I noted the point as well when how he just threatened to be at the courtroom and when Du Bois was in shackles, and that's what got the case thrown out. He could have done that. He could have done more. Thank you for including me. It's now 5 o'clock in the morning in Norway. This sun has started to come out. Thank you.
Early to rise. Counter racism. Wow. Hopefully one day we'll have this problem solved so we will all be able to sleep well and we will not have to get up early or stay up late as it relates to racism, white supremacy, narrating wacky books about racism, white supremacy, or anything else. Did we miss anybody?
I also would like to thank the reader for her work. Just wanted to make sure I included myself into that acknowledgement.
Much obliged, much obliged. Robust appreciation. Job well done for Mel down in California. I did actually have a couple. Let's see, my notes, the last few, because I don't think I shared from the final section that we covered. So, Paul Robeson, I'm so glad when, I think it was Miss C, she said that she didn't know a whole lot about Paul Robeson, and I think we heard that from a lot of folks when we read his bio not too long ago, Paul Robeson's bio not too long ago, and I myself didn't know, you know, a whole lot. I certainly didn't know that J. Edgar Hoover had tried to kill him all of these times and all the rest. Sorry. Some of that I did know from the FBI's war against Tupac Shakur and black leaders, because Paul Robeson is in that book, and Drugs as a Weapon Against Us. So I did know some things, but I didn't have as much information until we read Dr. Gerald Horn's biography. But I've heard that from many people, that they did not know a whole lot of information about Paul Robeson, which just shows how effective the system of white supremacy has been. Most people don't know anything about Paul Robeson. Like, might have an entertainer or something. Like, oh, okay. Not he spoke all these languages and studied law and devoted his life to fighting against racism, white supremacy, and gave up this monstrous salary and all the, extraordinary figure. His bio, there are many, but I mean, the one that Dr. Gerald Horn wrote is pretty good. But yeah, worth checking out, reading more information, his life and times. Extraordinary figure. That alone, if that was the result of people reading this book, like, wow, who is this Paul Robeson fellow? They tried to kill him all these times. Excellent. Read on. Let's see. Next. Oh, wait a minute. I didn't get the point. So Paul Robeson, Einstein, they are in this group to allegedly do away with the ACEL, which is supposed to do away with lynching, the American Crusade to End Lynching. They failed on all accounts. First point was the apprehension and punishment of all lynchers. Ha 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 ha. Number two, passage of federal... Actually, they don't even do that now. Number two, passage of a federal anti-lynching law. They haven't even passed that now. Number three, removal of Mississippi Senator Theodore Bilbo. They failed there too, I guess. They got some measure of success. He died. That's what ended his tenure, I believe, in 1947. But they didn't kill him. So unless you think they prayed or did some, you know, voodoo on him, they failed on all accounts. Senator Bilbo actually has a book. What is it? I think it's called Civilization or Mongrelization is the name of the book. Like, I had to go and double check to make sure I got the name, but I think that's what it's called. Civilization or Mongrelization. Like, I was like, oh, we should read that. Like, former governor in Mississippi, former United States Senator, former Mississippi State Senator. They just took the flag down and everything and go, we'll have to ponder. Let me get my other note. Let's see. They get a lot of black people for stealing those cigarettes, don't they? They had the other instance in the book. Sam Buchanan said he stole a pack of cigarettes. 14 years on it. Imagine that. 14 years for stealing a pack of cigarettes? 14 years? on a chain gang for stealing a pack of cigarettes, which at that time probably cost like a nickel. Like, woo, man. Einstein could have did a lot more. So, the dilemma for our next book. I would like to read White Dog, but I still don't have the book. Now, I think it is absurd. In fact, so absurd, I'm almost leaning to we should get this book for free. Like, no payment of any sort, not even a nickel. Just because some of the payments are absurd. It's like $800 for some of the copies of the book. Now, I mean, you can find one that's a little bit cheaper, but I mean, really. A book written by a suspected racist white man about a racist white dog. How much should we really pay for this book? And on top of all of that, we wouldn't even be having this dialogue. It would just be the next book is White Dog. Get a copy. They have this book at multiple Seattle libraries. Like, if it was not for the Rona, I would have already got this book. I probably would have already PDF'd it, and bang, get book. Anybody who wants it, we got it, and did it. So, we will have to see if we can acquire the book. That's one. If anybody has access, even if you have access, right, if you can, if you have the time and patience to screenshot, we wouldn't need the entire batch at once. If you could do, like, you know, 40, 50 pages at a time, like, per week, that would be enough. That would get us through. Like, you could stretch it out so you don't have to do it all in one setting and eat up all your time and energy, but, like, 40 pages, that's about our normal rate. Yeah, if you could do that, that would work. If somebody has access to a library that is currently open and they have the book, and you can get safely acquire it and get us a PDF of it, that is the next book. Now, if it, you know, fails, it looks like we're not going to be able to acquire the book in time. We will have to think of another book. Mr. Bilbo was, I was thinking, might be constructed. I actually was thinking we should try to pick the shortest book possible so that then we can get to White Dog immediately. In fact, I was even thinking we could read Dylan Roof's manifesto. Elliot Rodger was mentioned. He has a manifesto as well, which is fascinating. So I guess, yeah, that someone that had been requested before, that some of these folks who have gone out and done these shootings that dealt with white supremacy racism, and there's a manifesto attributed to them, perhaps we should give it a gander. Dylan Roof, Elliot Rodger, those are short. We could get through those pretty quick, and hopefully, I would think within a month, something will break, and we will be able to get to a library where we can make a PDF and White Dog. White Dog. The short synopsis, again. And the reason, man, the film is fantastic. I've said for like a decade, that's one of the best films I've ever seen about racism. And the aforementioned NAACP, they boycotted this film. Like, Jesus Lord. But I think it's one of the best films I've ever seen about white supremacy racism. You've got a racist dog who's been trained to kill black people, and that's the film. White woman finds him. I mean, there's more stuff, but I mean, you know, if you want to boil it down, that's the film. White woman finds him. He kills a few black people, mauls another black person. She freaks like, whoa, got to do something. Maybe this dog has a problem. And so she takes him to get him trained. They figure, oh, okay, he's a racist dog. All right, you got to kill him. She says, oh, no, you can't kill him. Can't kill him. And so a black trainer comes in, Mr. Keys, like in the book Keys to the Colors. Mr. Keys comes in, and he's going to try to train this dog to not be racist, and he fails. The end. That's the movie. That is not the book, which I was even more stunned. The freaking book is supposed to be loosely an autobiography. So this white man, author, Romain Gary, he comes to the States. He finds this dog. Turns out it's a racist dog. And in the book, he says it turns out it's a German Shepherd, that this is a former Alabama police dog. Edmund Pettus Bridge. So they find racist dog, he hates black people, blah, blah, blah. So they're going to see if they can train him. Just like in the movie, they take him to Mr. Keys, like in the book, Keys to the Colors. Black dog trainer or animal trainer, he takes him to Mr. Keys. Let's see if we can fix him to not be racist. This is where everything changes. In the book, Mr. Keys is a black Muslim. He trains the dog to attack white people. I crack up laughing because I did not know that at all. Like, total divergence from the film. The book does not end the way the film does. It's about halfway. You watch half of the movie, and it's pretty much like the book, sort of. But then it great divergence in what happens. That is why I said, oh, man, we got to read that. And the NAACP boycotted the It's so much. This is one of those books, like, if you want to do any background digging around this film, like, oh, man, he's talking about the Black Panther Party, and, man, we should have read this book a long time ago. So either White Dog is coming next week, if we can get our paws on it, or it will be, you know, immediately pending. If it is not next week, then, you know, we can make other selections. Like I said, I probably would be thinking something short that we can just motor through quickly in like 2 weeks, and then White Dog. That's why I said we could do Get on the Roof Manifesto if people think that would be constructive. We could do Elliot Rodger, the manifesto attributed to he and or Dylan Roof. We could do one of those if people think it would be constructive, or if people have another short text. I guess we're over time, but the folks that are here, people who participate in the book clubs, any thoughts on those suggestions? Actually, so yeah, any thoughts on the other suggestions? White Dog, that is not a vote. If I'm able to get my hands on it, that is the next book. Now, if I'm not able to get my hands on it, then yes, if folks have any thoughts about something other than White Dog, feel free. The manifestos or any other suggestions?
And I would probably vote for Dylan Roof's manifesto.
Okay.
I like Dylan Roof or any other like person's manifesto.
Okay. That had been suggested before. I'm remembering, and someone had said, like, hey, why don't y'all do that for the book club? That should count. Read one of these manifestos. I thought it was a constructive suggestion then, so kept that one on the hopper. All right.
I think it's also a good suggestion. I'm reading Stoddard's The Rising Tide right now, and one thing that comes into my head is there anyone at the similar level of Stoddard that is alive and writing right now and providing direction for white supremacy 100 years in the future?
Oh yeah,
someone who's that some of those writers.
We're kind of just limited to, if you have suggestions, just quick suggestions, because we're over time.
No, I don't have any. I'm good for Dylan Roof, but I'll try and come up to see if there's anyone like Stoddard for a few. Just.
Uh-oh. I heard the part. It sounded like your line was breaking up. I heard you were going to try to find something like Stoddard, an author like Stoddard who has given a prediction for white supremacy for the future. I heard that part, but it did sound like it was breaking up. Was that what you said?
Yes, sir. I think I'm good with Dylan Roof right now, but I just think he's kind of tiny, probably, and although he's got the core dynamic of racism going through him, and that can be interesting as someone who's white identified, it could be also interesting to have someone of Stoddard's level, like a PhD person who has written a book that is being used now, like Stoddard's was being used 100 years ago by the president. So
gotcha.
I think that could be interesting as well.
Gotcha. We will look out for that in the future also. If anyone has any suggestions, like I said, it would have to be, or I would prefer, something short. The energy would be focused on getting that book. If anybody's in an area where the public libraries are open, or any of the libraries are actually open, and you can safely do it, where you are not putting yourself at risk or anything like that, you could safely go to the library if they have a copy of White Dog that you can check out, and then you can safely scan it. Bang! That is all we need. We will be set for White Dog next Thursday. We will make it happen. Now, if we cannot, we'll have to see. I guess I would make do with Dylan Roof's manifesto. It's the five, I don't want to say anniversary, but it's been 5 years since the shooting, so And that would just be a placeholder until we can obtain White Dog. That's it. Much obliged for the folks tuning in. Kudos for Mel narrating. Hope it was constructive for the folks checking in for the broadcast. Did a little bit of overtime, but I was a little bit late getting started, too. I tried to, the computer, everything just shut down, like, repeatedly. I was trying to get started, and everything kept canceling out, so that delayed getting started, but persevered. Reading, more important than watching television. I hope folks said they were inspired. They read this and wanted to read a little bit more about Paul Robeson or check out some other things. So that is fantastic. I always feel like, hey, the book couldn't have been too bad if you get inspired to read another book based on that book. So, hey, I was even looking at Senator Bilbo, Civilization of Mongrelism. I think that's the name of it. Isn't that it? Did I get the book title right? Thanks to make sure. Oh, it's Take Your Choice. That's it. It's Take Your Choice, Separation or Mongrelization. That's it, from the great Senator Bilbo, former governor. This sounds like it'd probably be Pitchfork Ben Tillman. I suspect, even though we read a bio on that, but this sounds like it'd be in the same vein. Anyway, lots of great ones to pick from. Lots of great books out there to read. We'll try to nab another one for the book club soon, even a futuristic or a new age Lothrop Stoddard. There are lots of those fellows to pick from, too. Mr. Rush, that's one. He's up there in Canada, and matter of fact, he's written a lot. He was, I think, one of the co-authors on The Bell Curve. It's lots of those folks. Kevin McDonald, we've had him on the program twice. Now that I'm thinking about it, we've already had some of these folks on who've kind of given their prediction for what's going to. It kind of sounds some. Anyway, yeah, Kevin McDonald, I forgot his first name, but it might be Philip Rush. He's one of the co-authors, I think, with The Bell Curve. He's still alive. Anyway, we'll be here tomorrow for Neutralizing Workplace Racism. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Let's see. Is that one? I think it's two. 2 p.m. Norway time. How about that? Neutralizing Workplace Racism. And then we'll be here on Saturday. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Pacific. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. They poisoned Paul Robeson. I didn't know about that until I read John Patasha's book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, and the FBI's War Against Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. And I think the cows got a acknowledgement in both of those books. It is still a white author, suspected racist, but... What a trend. Every book that the cows, except for, I think, one or two, but almost every book where the cows get some sort of shout-out or acknowledgement, like, woo, man, oh, man, lots of reasons to cringe. Sobriety would be best, though. That was the whole point for mentioning that. Mr. Robeson, they poisoned his drink. I don't think it was alcoholic per se, but they do a lot of slipping Mickeys in people's beverages. Let's keep all of that to a minimum. Don't drink to begin with. I'm not at the bar. I don't do all that. So you don't have that opportunity. And then I don't consume alcohol. I don't smoke cigarettes and none of your other narcotics or any of that. So I am minimizing your opportunities to mess with my brain computer. In addition to being sober, we are buckled. Forget the Rona. Forget the Rona. Armed white people. Wow. You talk about Lothrop Stoddard. Rising tide of color against white world supremacy. Like, wow. This here week, I don't know about the whole world. This is might just be a U.S. thing. In fact, I suspect it's just a U.S. thing because that's all the reports. So this is not worldwide. No way. And everybody else, you all can, you know, business as usual on the plantation. The United States, like, wow. This is not the time to be out gallivanting, horsing around. This is not summer fun at all. This is the summer of armed race soldiers. If you are going out, I would be super alert about what is happening around you. Does it look like somebody is, you know, coming towards me, might be hostile and aggressive, people I don't know, total strangers? Super vigilant, because there have been more reports than I have seen ever of black people being attacked violently in public, just drop of a dime. In fact, that might be the entire compensatory call-in audio segment this weekend. It's just black people being attacked, which has never happened. Might be this weekend, though. That many incidents. That would be reason enough, I would seriously consider. I'm going to chill. I'm not just going to be out and about right now. Don't need to be any large crowds, groups, any of that. I'm going to be real strategic. If you have to go out to get this, run errands, work, things for your offspring, whatever it is, do that. I'm vigilant while it's happening. I'm avoiding skirmishes with white people. If you have to defend yourself, that's fine. But, man, it looks like so many of these white folks are armed. It goes from a name or shouting or whatever to, wow, pistol is out. Assault rifle is out. Have that in mind as you are moving about in the world. This is just for the folks in the States. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy, no name calling. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
no
brother.
Problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.